Okay, good morning. Good morning and welcome to the Fish and Game Commission meeting for April 9th here in Lodi, California. Thank you for joining us today. A few introductions to start off. I'm Cindy Gustafson. I'm honored to be the president this year of the commission. I'm from Tahoe City, California. And one gentleman over here to my left is our vice president, Mr. Jim Kellogg from Concord, California. To my right, Commissioner Richard Rogers from Carpinteria, California. Next to him is Mr. Michael Sutton. He is from Monterey, California, and Daniel Richards from Upland, California. John Carlson is right to my left here. He is right to my left. Now, that was a good introduction. Directly to my left is our executive director, John Carlson, and at the table over to the far left are our staff, Anita Biederman, Carol Horn, and Sherry Fombueno. John Carlson at the end of this table. John Fisher, sorry. Thank you. John Fisher, our Deputy Executive Director. Deborah Barnes, Deputy Attorney General. And at the far right, we have Adriana Shea, Deputy Executive Director. Over at the table to my right is Director Don Cook of the Department and Deputy Director Sankey Mastrup. We also have Deputy Director Nancy Foley in the back of the room. We also have a couple chiefs, Neil Manges from our wildlife branch, and I think fisheries, Eric Loff from the wildlife branch, and Scott Barrow is with us as well from the department. Also, we have two wardens here today. We have James Bogus and Erica Hatchie. I'll get that right yet, Erica. Thank you for being here. Is there anyone else I should introduce, Mr. Carlson, as I stumbled through that?
I think we're good.
Okay.
Thank you. To start today's meeting, we have a few items from yesterday that we weren't able to finish up, but I wanted to give a little bit of housekeeping information. Please recall that all of our meetings are filmed and live streamed over the internet. They're also then archived, and they're available via our website, a link from our website to be viewed. It's a free service, so if you ever want to look at a meeting that's happened in the past, over the last 6-7 years, go ahead and check that out. Please keep in mind that this is a Bagley-Keene meeting. We don't tolerate disturbances. If you're in the audience and you have something to say, fill out a green card for a agenda item. You can speak at the microphone and make your public comments. We have an aggregate of 10 minutes per day. And the president sets the time per item. So turn those cards into staff. If you have written materials, when you're going to speak, turn them into staff before you get to the podium. With that, we will start with item number 6 from yesterday. Scoping of possible department and commission 2009 upland game regulation change proposals. Dr. Eric Loft from the wildlife branch will be giving us an introduction on that.
Good morning, President Gustafson, Commissioners. As I sat in the back and watched Fisheries Chief Manji get buzzed yesterday afternoon, I realized why it is that when I get up here, I miss every other thought that I have, and the rest I realize aren't all that important anyhow. So that kind of negative reinforcement may be helpful in speeding things along. Item 6 is scoping on possible changes to the upland game regulations for the coming year, and really what this is the chance for the commission and the public to give us some guidance and thoughts about what changes they'd like to see made in upland game regulations for pheasant, turkey, quail, dove, and the resident small mammals as well. Of significance, however, is one of the items that's in this package is due to the settlement agreement related to condor and condor range. The department has prepared for the commission's consideration an option related to method of take in section 311, methods for taking resident small game, and in this case specifically mammals, that the option would include prohibition of lead ammunition for the take of rabbits, hares, as well as tree squirrels. And those are the three particular categories of species per the agreement. Now, I will tell you that the department is not recommending this because in the history of the Department of Fish and Game, there is no evidence of a hunter killed rabbit, hare, or tree squirrel being consumed and eaten by a condor. So we're not proposing this and recommending it. It's just an option that's in there per the settlement agreement. However, we're quite well aware enough within the department that the recent events of the two condors that have been hit by lead, Commissioner Rogers mentioned this yesterday, and it'll probably be a topic again on the condor update. It certainly fits in well here in this topic as well as something I think for the commission to consider what the implications of that is, as it sounds like, it appears like it was a shotgun perhaps wound to those condors that were hit. So other than that, we're ready to take any guidance, options, recommendations from the commission and the public on this topic.
Commissioner Gustafson?
Thoughts before we go to...
A quick point of clarification. The proposal on the no lead for hares, rabbits, and tree squirrels is only specific to the condor range. It may not have been clear from Eric's presentation. It is not a statewide option. It's just specific to the Ridley condor range.
And I want to clarify, that's just a proposal. It's not a recommendation.
Correct. Our agreement is that we would put before the commission an option to eliminate the use of lead. It is simply an option for your consideration.
I just wanted to make sure the full commission understood that.
We have three speaker cards from the public on this, commissioners. Ed Worley, Bill Gaines, and Tom Pedersen. For item six, you guys still interested in speaking? This was carryover from yesterday. Okay, Tom? Bill? I knew Bill wouldn't pass. Come on now.
I guess through the process of elimination, my name is Bill Gaines, and I'm the president of the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance. It's a pleasure to be here again today. In regards to the upland game scoping for 2009, we would like the commission to ask the department to take a serious look into the possibility of opening turkey hunting on Gray Lodge Wildlife Area as well as the Upper Butte Basin Wildlife Areas beginning this coming fall. They already get a tremendous amount of pheasant hunting and other types of hunting up there during the fall. It would only make sense to also offer them turkey hunting. We understand that there's a lot of turkeys on those areas, and there's no reason why they shouldn't be enjoying some harvest of those birds as well. I don't see any additional staff costs associated with doing that because, again, they are already open and they are already hunting upland birds during that time. So if the commission could ask the department to seriously consider such a opening this coming fall, we'd greatly appreciate it. Thank you.
I know we discussed this at the Tosher meeting, Sankey, but I'd like to... First of all, I think that in view of the fact that there's rumors out there that because of the drought that the wild pheasant population is kind of in trouble as well, that it might not be a good idea to consider opening up turkey hunting in some of those Gray Lodges and some of the other areas that don't allow it already, to because they're competing with the pheasants for that same habitat, and that's another avenue to look at when you're considering that that we didn't mention yesterday or 2 days ago at the Tosher meeting. But I think we got more comments from the public on this before we...
We're done
with the public comment?
That was the only public comment.
What would it take to open in the coming fall turkey season?
Well, the regulations for hunting on our wildlife areas are through our wildlife area regulations, which are separate than the regulations that you typically adopt, the upland game rules. That's certainly an option. We were not planning on making significant or if any changes in the wildlife area regulations this year, but if you would want to consider allowing turkey hunting on Gray Lodge, for example, we would have to open up the wildlife area regs, and there's time to do that. So if that's your pleasure, we could prepare an option for that. But now's the time to start working on it if that's what you're interested in. So we'd like direction from you to, in fact, do that if that's what you would like to see.
I personally would very much like to see it, and I'd like to have a recommendation come forward to us that allows it. Well, actually, I want a recommendation that comes forward to us that justifies it. If it doesn't justify it, then we need to know that.
Right. Any recommendation would come with some background, any data we might have one way or the other on the pros or cons, and what kind of opportunity it might provide. And
well, I mean, we're talking specifically about Gray Lodge, but if there's other wildlife areas that have a turkey population now that don't presently offer the hunting, I think we should take a look at all of them if we're going to do it.
All right.
I mean, some of us are certainly about hunting opportunities for everybody, and that's a legitimate hunting opportunity. I mean, turkeys are a pest in a big part of the state right now, and if there's an opportunity, rather than have them taken with depredation permits, for people to hunt them and get their own turkey for Thanksgiving dinner, then I think we ought to provide that opportunity to the public.
All right, so what we'll do then is we'll peruse what opportunities might exist on our wildlife areas for turkey hunting then.
Perfect. I agree with that.
Okay, any other commissioner comments?
No more public speakers.
I just want to say a couple things on this subject. This is a scoping discussion, so, and I realize that we have a settlement agreement and so forth. The two things that persuade me that we need to look at this are the overall desire to get lead out of the food chain of the condor. So if these animals are part of the food chain, then we need to look at that. Secondly, after being told a couple of years ago that it was very difficult technically to produce non-lead 22 rimfire ammunition, we now have something like at least three sources of that. And so, you know, it's just a classic example of manufacturers responding to a new market. And all of a sudden, we have an option to shoot non-lead rimfire ammunition, again, making it feasible to look at small game. So I'd like to see that as part of your scoping document.
Yeah. So would I from that perspective. I'd also like to talk to Nancy. Her thoughts on enforcement. My assumption, Nancy, is that it's easier for enforcement if someone is in the condor area to cite someone if they have lead ammunition rather than, you know, what that's going to be used for. Because guys can use a .22 for a whole bunch of things, not just squirrels and rabbits and things. So it would seem to me that it's easier to enforce if lead ammunition of any kind, shotgun shells or whatever, is not in the condor area, isn't it?
That's right. Good morning, Commissioners. Nancy Foley, Chief of the Law Enforcement Division. The tighter the regulations are and the more consistent they are, the easier they are to enforce.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in other words, possession as opposed to use. You just can't carry it. I mean, it's like in waterfowl hunting. I mean, I've been a waterfowl hunter all my life, and I thought, oh, God, you know, that using steel was going to be terrible. Well, we've been using steel for, what, since the 70s now. I mean, you know, and you understand how to, you understand your leads. You know, you understand what shot you need for what. It seems to me it's just easier to go that way than it is to have the warden have to, well, talk to some guy, and he says, well, I'm not really using it right now for that. Since it's available, not lead is available, why not go to it? It's just easier.
No more public comments. If we can move ahead now.
Okay. Department, did you get the direction you needed?
Cindy.
Yes, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Thank you. A couple things. In general, I am not in favor of any lead bans because I don't see any science whatsoever that proves up what all the allegations are. I see lots of science that actually says something different. But regardless of that, just so that there's clarity, there is rimfire lead 22 ammunition, which is 2 to 3 times more expensive at least, and a whole lot of weapons can't use it. So it's just not a matter of it's just real available and it makes a lot of sense, and it actually precludes a whole lot of people just from simply the weapons that they have, let alone the cost issue. Having said that, we do have a lead ban in the Condor range, and I'm of the opinion that it actually might be helpful to the sporting community, and particularly those of us who are opposed to bans on lead, to do the very same thing for the small game in that area, so that the science we have now a controlled area and the Condors, and so we'll have science that we can look at and determine does this really make a difference or not. I can assure you there are different differences of opinion today on the effectiveness of the lead ban in the Condor range. So since it already exists, I would be more likely to actually allow that, given we have a controlled area and it gives us an opportunity to really take a look, is it working or not?
I want to support that, Madam President. We have lots of baseline information from before lead ammunition was banned in the Condor habitat, and so we ought to, I think you're right, Dan, we ought to be able to see changes as a result of that. In terms of the science, I think it was before you joined the commission, but we might want to dig into our files and dig out a letter we received from the University of California signed by more than 40 academic scientists commenting on the state of our knowledge and science in terms of the need to remove lead from the Condor's food chain. It was a very persuasive letter, I recall, at the time. This was a couple of years ago. I may have it in my files I can dig out, but I know we have it in the commission files. But it's just wrong to say that there's no science supporting this. And we specifically heard from a lot of different scientists. There's a scientific debate, of course, like there is in everything, but this letter was, I remember, being particularly persuasive from the academic community.
I agree that there's debate. That's the important thing. And if I said there's no scientific evidence to indicate it's a problem, then I misspoke, because I certainly understand there are those who would say there is. But there's certainly equal weight on the other side, including from the Center for Disease Control, the national center the federal government maintains, saying that the lead shot is not dangerous to the public. Now, the Condor is a different case, and I know everybody's got an opinion on it. So I would submit that you're correct. There's debate on both sides of that. And hence, the baseline, what you were just saying, that's why I'd actually probably go for this, because we've got a controlled area. Let's see what happens with the Condors. Let's see what these lead levels are. And then we'll have something more concrete to have this debate about.
Commissioner Kellogg?
Yeah, I just, you know, I was here when all those people from UC sent the letter in, and they were asked a question then. And the science has proven that the Condors are getting contaminated with lead. That's not the question. The question is, there has been no science proven that it's lead bullets or lead shot that's poisoning the Condor. And I've said all along that if we do this ban and hunters are not allowed to use lead in the Condor range, the Condors are going to continue to die from lead poisoning, because I don't believe that that's where it's coming from. They're scavengers and they're getting lead poison from all other types of material that they eat. And it's not proven, to my satisfaction, that it's lead bullets and lead shot that's causing Condors to die at.
Commissioner Rogers.
Well, I'll weigh in on this one too. First of all, I am persuaded that Dan's argument is a good one. You know, whether you agree or don't agree on whichever side you want to weigh in on whether or not the isotopic signature match for the lead. It's kind of like, you know, the O.J. case in DNA to me. I mean, to me, it's prima facie, but there is a relationship. But that put entirely aside, I think what you're saying is very pragmatic, and I think it's a, I think it's an excellent idea to make a complete isolated place, and then let's take a look over the next few years and see if the birds continue to get. And we'll have to wait a certain period of time until all that stuff does get out of the food chain, but we'll just take a look at that and see if that in fact does. Because my sense of it is, and I know this is a somewhat unpopular sense in some places, we should get let out of the food chain, period, in the state of California, condor range or not. And I know there's no science right now that supports that position. But I think philosophically, I don't understand the idea of spreading lead around in the environment. I've never have. But then again, I can afford steel shot over over lead shot. So maybe that's just my socioeconomics talking as opposed to someone who is more challenged in that regard. So, I understand that. And please understand this is coming from someone who owns a lot of shotguns and who hunts as often as he possibly can. So.
Okay. Sankey?
Yes, commissioners. This has been a very interesting debate to listen to. However, now I need some... ask a few questions because this conversation's wandered beyond what we originally had introduced.
Well, welcome to the Fish and Game Commission, Sankey.
Absolutely, and this is wonderful to listen to.
Are you surprised? Is that's interesting.
No, I'm glad you're going to try to clarify it because I was looking at you like, what direction did you get?
Thank you.
We'll try to get you a better direction.
All right.
Here.
As you know, what Eric presented you was simply terms based on the settlement agreement to ban lead for literally tree squirrels, rabbits, and hares in condor range. The discussion you guys were just having on this experiment in condor range seemed to indicate to us that you want to consider banning all use of lead for hunting in that range. That's different than what we propose. So if you're pursuing that, we would need direction to include things like quail and dove, bandtail pigeons, whatever, because that was not what we were discussing earlier. So
that is precisely what I would propose, simply because it's infinitely easier from an enforcement perspective, and it gives us, as Dan was suggesting, a tightly controlled area, and we can actually see how effective it is to get lead out of the entire food chain. Because as we know, in marine fisheries, there's a chain of, for example, mercury poisoning and other things, other forms of toxicity that go all the way up into larger pelagic animals. So to me, it is a smart thing for the state of California to use the condor area is almost a test area to test this theory. And if, in fact, there is no relationship, then it's not going to get to the rest of California. Philosophically, however, I would like it to. But that's
I agree with that.
I'm going to agree with it as well. You know, I think we need a baseline study. We need to have an area. This is the perfect scenario. We'll take a look at the condors. We'll see what happens to them. And I have my opinions about what that'll be, but we'll wait and see and let the science actually prove it out versus anything else.
So, Sankey, I mean, the null hypothesis would be in the condor range that you would see a decline in blood lead levels over time. Now, what time frame we're talking about is a better question for the scientists, but I agree with my colleagues here that the best test case would be to remove all sources of lead from hunted animals in the range, and believe me, I'm a bird hunter, big game hunter. I own 22s as well. This is going to affect me like anybody else hunting in that area, and it's right in my back door, backyard. So, but I think if we really want to find out once and for all whether this is in fact the source that is poisoning condors, as the scientists and the managers out there suspect, then we need to get the variables off the table and get lead out of the food chain entirely to the extent we can.
And that's what I thought I started hearing there in the discussion, so I just wanted to make clear because...
I personally think it's critical to do that, Sankey, because, you know, hunters are genuinely sportsmen. I mean, everyone that I know really is, except those jerks who shot the condors a couple of weeks ago. Can't believe that, but those are just jerks. You know, they're not members of, you know, I mean, they're not members of any organized hunting group or organized gun group, because people in those groups have a tendency to be in the group because they are sportsmen. I mean, they're genuinely concerned about the environment. So, to me, if we can do this experiment for however long, it'll get that specter off of the gun owners and hunters in the state of California, that they are somehow contributing to the demise of something in the food chain. Well, that's not, I mean, get rid of it. Get it off the plate if, in fact, Dan is right and there's no correlation. But if there is a correlation, I don't know a single hunter who would want to continue doing something that endangers an endangered species. My friends just wouldn't do that.
I agree with the, sorry.
I was just going to try to summarize and see how we go address this issue within this item on the agenda, because this is one of the options then that the department would bring back to us.
Yes, since this is a scoping meeting, we were angling for ideas. Mm-hmm. We got a big one here. So based on the direction I'm perceiving here from the commission, one of our options we would come back to you.
It's an option.
Would be a complete ban of lead for upland game, whatever, in the condor range.
So that would be one of the options.
An additional option to the one that they're
proposing
as a result of a lawsuit.
Right, right.
Yeah, we would add this as another option.
That's what
so you'd have the settlement option, you would have this complete option, and of course the no change option.
Okay. Yeah. And so then we take public comment on all that and bring it back on the agenda. Okay.
We
can continue discussing it, but we're going to have this debate, I'm sure.
Yes.
With public in the room knowing that option's out there.
One clarification, we don't have the authority, in my understanding, to cover like target shooting.
No, this would only be for hunting. Regulations the commission has purview over.
So I just want to make that clear.
Yes.
But John, that doesn't bother me, because target shooting presumably doesn't affect animals, and therefore there's no direct link to the condor food chain. Yeah, exactly. The condors don't have much appetite for targets, but. I'm also persuaded by something my Commissioner Rogers said earlier. We need to clear the air on this subject, because it's not doing us, those of us in the hunting community, any good for the public to think that we care more about our guns and ammo than we do about the state's wildlife. That's a big mistake, in my opinion, for the hunting position for the hunting community to take, because it alienates us from the rest of the public, and I don't think that's in our best interest. So I'm going to be watching this closely.
Okay. Any other comments? There's no action on this item, correct? We move forward. Okay. Sankey, you had another question?
One quick note. Trust me, I'm not real interested in extending this conversation at the moment. But just as a fair warning, as you know, part of the Ridley Condor Act was required to report to the commission on progress based on largely mammal hunting. This is going to tweak it. So the report may be a little different or added. It's going to adjust the report. I just wanted to warn you that this was going to modify it a little bit, and we're trying to put our heads around it. But just so you know, that's a word of warning.
We know great minds will figure this out.
I just want to ask that report would come quicker than the one that we were supposed to get prior to the ban on lead, and we were having a educational deal on hunters in the condor range to voluntarily quit, and we were going to get a report on that, and we still haven't got it. So I hope this report will come a little quicker so we can know what we're working with.
We'll do our best.
Thank you.
So we actually now, this is kind of a good segue, because we're cutting right now to 8C, which is status update on the report regarding the levels of lead found in California condors during 2008. Note the commission is required to issue this report by June of 2009 pursuant to section 3004.5 of the Fish and Game Code. Dr. Loft.
Commissioners, again, Eric Loft with the Wildlife Branch. On that report, this item 8C, status update on the report, What we are intending to do is try to obtain all the information that's available. We are dependent upon the Fish and Wildlife Service to provide us this data. We don't have it. We're waiting for them to give us the final numbers for the past year or so to put it in a report, compile it, and deliver it to you for your May meeting so that you'll have it at the May meeting in advance of when you need to submit it in June. What we're hearing so far, Dale Steele, who's on the recovery team for us, is hearing already that, in my words, we may be underwhelmed by what's in there because of fire issues last year may have precluded from them collecting a lot of data. I'm not sure. Like I say, we have not seen anything yet on the report, so we have no indications of what it's going to look like or what the data is for this report. I only say that because of Commissioner Kellogg's comment there that he wants this report and that it will give the answers. I'm going to be surprised if it gives us any clear-cut answers at this early stage of the game. So we'll do what we can. We're going to get that report and submit it through our system. We hope by internally submit it to the directorate by the 15th of this month so that we'll be able to provide it in time for your May meeting.
Eric, a question for you, if I may. How would you assess the I've heard little twitters, little rumors from the trees that the feds are not being particularly cooperative with respect to this data need that we have. Would you assess that as being accurate?
I think this is a new era and a new game for them, as well as for us having to have that entire Condor program pull together and have it all presented in an organized fashion. We struggled, I will tell you, a couple of years ago trying to get the data organized to find out what was going on with the history of lead. And in part, it's due to the Fish and Wildlife Service as the lead, but then they sub out with MOUs to NGOs and to the zoos to collect the data. And in doing that, it just has seemed to us from the department's perspective that it didn't all roll up into a clean package at the Fish and Wildlife Service. I think part of the work that we've having Dale do is try to help orchestrate and get that so that it is more clean cut and that more comprehensive data so that it all comes in. We get the monthly updates on the status of condors throughout the West. In our opinion, that data ought to include tables as it relates to lead levels as well. It's pretty basic information.
Was that a yes or a no?
That's a sort of.
Okay, so is there anything, based upon what you said, which I'm not sure what that was.
Whether they've been upfront and cooperative in delivering the data?
Commissioner Rogers, can I jump in? I think, you know, and I think Eric, what Eric was saying, because of the number of people involved in it, just physically amassing the data, but I do want to indicate that the regional director for the Fish and Wildlife Service, Ren Lofender, and I have a really good relationship, and if there's an issue there, Ren and I talk.
Yeah, so what I've been hearing is probably inaccurate. Is what you're saying.
I don't know the answer to that, but if there is a problem, Ren and I.
Well, if there is a problem, you would know
you
about
bet.
It.
You so. Bet, and like you say, we have a really good relationship with.
Well, if there's anything that we could do, like a letter to someone or something, my colleagues may, after a discussion of this, may be interested in doing that, because we certainly want to get this regularized in the information flowing.
I think if I had to say it in a sentence, I'd say that our priorities to get information to you, the commission, are not necessarily always their priorities.
Doctor. And yet, you know, they may not, in fact, understand the intensity of the public interest in this from our previous discussion here a few minutes ago.
And I think
you're
right.
It's all interrelated, and they don't have the same problem we do.
Think you're exactly right. I don't think they're watching this process as closely as we all are and have to or have been, because they didn't watch it, but they weren't involved in it before.
And I think this commission, and I know the department, is extremely sensitive to the informational needs of the general hunting public and the general public who are the drivers in terms of the intensity of the discussion on this issue. So if they're not forthcoming in terms of relating with the department and getting providing a regular means to present this information, that's a real problem for a whole bunch of people in the state of California, not just the department and the commission.
And I think the whole recovery team is working towards that end to be able to provide that more comprehensive information.
Okay. Commissioner just Sutton.
Quick question, Dr. Loft. It sounds like we're going to get this report before or maybe contemporaneously with the Upland Game regulation proposals, the package. Is that coming to our May meeting? What's the timing on the latter?
Typically on Upland Game, we would go to notice at the June.
June, okay.
Well, maybe it is May.
I think it's May.
Yeah, May meeting.
Okay.
So you would, in that package, you would get any information we had relative to Upland Game and this lead issue as part of the background information.
And we'll get this report at the same time. That's good.
Yeah.
Good.
Okay. Thank you.
Eric, real quick before you leave, one other thing I want to bring to the commissioner's attention is in your correspondence packet, there is a copy of the Memorandum of Understanding between the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Department of Fish and Game regarding California Condor Recovery Program in the state of California. The commission has the ultimate approval authority on this MOU, and there's a lot of information in this MOU on the relationship and how the department and the service relate to each other on data exchange and cooperation. So I just want to bring it to your attention. There's a copy here. It comes to us every couple of years, I believe, for a fresh approval. But if the commissioners ever have any changes they feel in this, or the department has any changes, or the service, they'll be brought to us, and then we can have another discussion on it and look at updating it or modifying it. But so there is that document, and I know some commissioners probably haven't seen it since they've been on the commission. It doesn't come. I think the last time it came before us was in August of 06. So,
well, it's one thing is patently obvious to anybody who's including Dr. Loft. I mean, there is a very different sense of interest in this issue than there was a couple of years ago. And so perhaps it is the case that MOU needs to be tightened up in some way to be consistent with the level of public interest in this, no matter which side of the issue you're on. You know, because what we need are policies that are based upon good science and good public policy, not somebody's ideas that are much older than predate perhaps even the UC Santa Cruz 40 scientists isotopic match letter.
I think you're right, Commissioner Rogers, and Dale Steele, who's been leading this for us on the recovery team, has been working, as far as I know, to try to tighten up and help explain to the others what the requirements of that MOU are. And if we need to tighten some things up still further because of this heightened importance, we should be working on that for sure.
We do have, we'll move on to 8F, and at the end of 8, we have three public speaker cards. If anyone else wants to speak on all of 8, please turn in your card to staff. 8F is update on enforcement. Chief Nancy Foley.
Good morning again, Commissioners. Nancy Foley, Chief of the Law Enforcement Division. I have a couple of updates for you. The first, I will give you the update on the academy. We still have 25 new cadets in the academy, and that's a good thing. They're a little beat up, bruised, and have minor bone breaks, but if bone breaks can be minor. They're still in the academy, and going forward, we still have a number of unsponsored candidates there as well. So they're in their fourth month. They have about 2.5-3 months more to go, and we look forward to their graduation. This has been a really challenging academy. They started the academy, then they got a 10% reduction in pay, then they got a pink slip, and to see that they're still going forward, they still have a great attitude, and they still want to be game wardens is encouraging. There was another academy, and that was a senior volunteer academy in Los Angeles County. We graduated 8 senior volunteers in Los Angeles County. Those people help us on a department-wide basis. It's not just for enforcement. They help us with surveillance of our wildlands, Let us know when gates and signs are down. They help us with human-wildlife conflict. They go to neighborhoods where we have coyote problems, and they tell people how to live with coyotes. They do some vehicle shuttling. So it's a really important program for the department. We have an opportunity to partner with the Missouri Foundation and expand the senior volunteer program to Northern California. And at the director's request, we're pursuing that and hoping to get it into Northern California sometime by the summer. And that will benefit Northern California as well. We plan on starting another academy in January of 10 for wardens. With our current vacancies and the augmentation of 15 additional game warden positions in the governor's budget, we hope to be able to fill that academy with 35 to 40 new game wardens. With all of our recruitment efforts, we have a good pool of candidates to start backgrounds on, and we're already in the background process trying to identify those people that will be going to the academy in January of 10. On another challenging note, the California District Attorneys Association represents the environmental crimes in many rural counties throughout the state of California, counties that don't have enough prosecutorial staff to handle everything that they have. Unfortunately, CDAA is looking at disbanding that program, from what I've heard, in the next several months due to the economic crisis that everybody's in. That's really going to impact some of the prosecutions in the rural counties. And we're not only finding it in rural counties with CDAA, but we're also finding it in urban counties where they're no longer prosecuting misdemeanor crimes, not only ours, but others as well, penal code crimes. They're only taking a couple, and they'll prosecute those. So I suspect in the next 2 years we're going to face some pretty challenging times with wildlife crimes, unless we figure something else out.
Nancy, do you think a letter from the commission would at all assist?
It always helps. You know, it always helps to say that somebody cares.
Okay.
So the counties, the county Fish and Game Commissions, your commission, letters of support always help and move that forward.
Okay, so if that's okay with the rest of the commissioners, let's have our executive director work with Nancy on that.
Nancy, I don't know if there's such a thing as a pro bono prosecutor, but if there is, I'll volunteer.
Actually, we're looking at a number of different things, and including department staff, although department legal staff is already overwhelmed, that we may have some options to going into counties and helping, but we're still in negotiations over that. Everything costs money, and money's tight everywhere, so we're looking at a number of options.
You know, in my experience with wildlife crime, prosecuting wildlife crimes, your average district attorney or assistant DA, and United States attorney for that matter, finds wildlife crimes much more interesting than the run-of-the-mill, you know, prosecuting tax cases and various other things. So I hope that we can find some volunteers who are interested in doing this among the various offices around the state.
You know, there's also a possibility at my age I have some retired judges as friends, and a lot of those guys and gals really do want to remain involved in the judicial system, and I'll bet that we might be able to find some newly retired judges who actually could become wildlife specialists. That might be something that we could do, and they might be enthusiastic about that because they may themselves be hunters or fishermen or be interested in wildlife. It's an interesting idea, maybe, to involve them, because there are plenty of people who thought that retirement was a good idea and find that it isn't.
I don't know the process for establishing anything like that, but we're looking into all of our options.
Yeah.
Well, perhaps the commission's letter could address some ideas like that as well, and see if there's a response. So
I'm not picking up any covert signals from your AG over there, so I'll just go forward with the next one.
Okay.
We did receive a grant from EPA for some marijuana cleanups, and we received about $200,000 to go into some of the marijuana grows that we identified as accessible to groups to come in and assist us with the cleanups. And we have so far, I think, completed like three or four of them, and they've all been a huge success. So I talked about that at the Altoucher Committee, and some of those groups are also stepping up to the plate and offering some of their assistance for some of the cleanups. Along that same line, we are in marijuana season again. We've already identified some marijuana grows out there, so all of our constituents, hunters, fishers, hikers, anglers, need to be careful as they go into our wildlands. And then I always try and close with some local cases, and we have two of our newer game wardens that have drawn the duty for security in the commission room these last 2 days, and they graduated from the academy in August. They finished their FTO programs and were in their positions in this local area as of January. And from what I understand, Warden Bogus was in his patrol truck just the other day with 1,100 pounds of freshwater clams in the back. And we find this has been a reoccurring problem, that you're allowed to have 50 pounds legally, and he was seizing 300 pounds at a time from people. We believe that there's a lot of commercial activity in freshwater clams, which is a little bit frightening considering where they come from. Most of them are coming from irrigation ditches, from agricultural fields, so there's probably some there are health and safety issues involved with it, and they'll continue their investigations as we go forward. But that's some of the local. This is also a huge turkey area, and they worked the last couple of weekends on the turkey opener, and they've both been pretty successful in that. So any questions?
You know, I guess it just raises that question of what we can do with the public to educate them that if they are offered freshwater clams, you know, what the those health risks are too. And, you know, I think so many of the public are naive to the issues that we hear about with illegal commercialization, and that's a real health threat. Do we put out any notifications or to the press on those sorts of things?
Well, when we finish our investigation of some of these crimes, we put out press releases to notify the public of what is going on, whether it's sturgeon, mm-hmm. caviar, mm-hmm. stripers, or freshwater clams. And right. So we continue to do that, but it doesn't always reach the people that it needs to reach, and then people are rather assuming that if it's in a market, it's legal to be there.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, thank you, Nancy. And thanks to our great wardens across the state, and especially the two that are with us today. Thank you for the great job you do.
That brings us to item 8G, update on Pacific Fishery Management Council issues. Late yesterday afternoon, our blackberries were humming with breaking news from that meeting. I'm sure Sankey can fix this up.
Actually, the primary news is salmon-related, and we would prefer, if at your pleasure, to bring this up under the salmon items, since they directly affect the proposals, if that would be, since it's going to be discussed. Otherwise, I have nothing else to report yet on the council. We'll bring any other issues to you at the next meeting.
And I know of no other items under other 8H, other?
Well, Sankey has one, it looks like.
Yeah,
more than one?
Just one item.
Okay.
And this is just informational strictly. As you know, herring has been a dear subject to the commission and the public in the past. Just as a warning, next week we will be having one of the director's herring advisory committee meetings. And in that meeting, the department will be sharing the latest bioassessment of the herring stocks. The news is not good at all. So it's way down, and that we'll be discussing that with the herring fishermen. But just, I wanted to warn you in case you get phone calls next week after the herring meeting about what's going on. And we will be discussing more of that, obviously, during the regulatory cycle. But apparently we're going to have one of the lowest biomass counts we've ever recorded. So that's difficult. So we'll see. I just wanted to give you a heads up.
Okay. Thanks for the heads up on that.
We don't have to keep that secret till next week, right? I mean, I'm just kidding. We have three speaker cards from the public for item 8. Paul Weakland, Ed Worley, Tom Pedersen.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. Well, yesterday you talked about aquaculture, but you didn't do a very good job. Still, we request the guiding philosophies and principles of why ocean ranching, the trials and tests and studies of ocean ranching have been eliminated from the record. You're hiding information. You're missing history. You're rewriting it again. The fish hatcheries and farms and aquaculture in California started in 1888. But the history has been lost, purged from the files, cleansed. Yesterday we heard that nothing has been done on aquaculture. Well, this is a calculated maneuvering. That there is a joint committee on aquaculture and fisheries. Well, that's been going on for a long time. That they are given a list of topics now and an idea to craft definitions. A report has been submitted, and we have asked for a copy. Leases for shellfish growers needs legal standards, we were told. Oh, that doesn't exist yet? We think that that is not being honestly represented. That brings up past conduct and practices, the violations that have already occurred. What penalties, what punishments, when fines? Has all the past committees, rules, and laws been thrown out, purged, cleansed, lost from the file? Looks like it. The record, like ocean ranching, which Richard Rogers and you voted to eliminate from the record, what failures were they? Well, there were many. That's why you don't want to look at it any longer. It was a benchmark, a milepost, a baseline study thrown away. Better to study again with no conclusions. You would have to admit failure if you left it in the record. Is that not the goal? Mission failure? We have been taught many lessons, but not allowed to learn. All the mistakes, goofs, and oops, the problems not reported. A lack of integrity and honesty is apparent. Who is responsible? Who is accountable? They're going to start over again, these rascals, the unethical, a fresh new start again. Also, tell us about the recent confiscations of abalones that the Fish and Game Wardens did with the South African parasite, cibellid worm, a polychaete. What is the outcome of that? Please summarize. Where's our deputy director? Director? Zonkey? Maybe he can tell us about these confiscations from the aquaculture industry of these abalones with the cibellid worm. How many facilities? Just in Santa Barbara or San Luis Obispo, too? Hey, want to buy some shares in an aquaculture pyramid? How about stock in a Mariculture Ponzi Consortium?
Mr. Weakland, your time is up.
How many fish farms have gone bankrupt?
Mr. Weakland, your time is up.
They're always looking for more investors.
Thank you, Mr. Weakland.
Ed Worley, followed by Tom Pedersen.
Good morning.
Good morning. President Gustafson, members of the commission, Ed Worley with the National Rifle Association. In the Condor report, I would like to make some recommendations on further information we need. I agree with Commissioner Rogers that the more information we have globally about the entire condor population, all of us want to protect the condors, all of us want to see them thrive and balance the use of the resources with what we have to do. But I would recommend that we also include some other information. Some of the things I've been reading about, including that there's been a lot of deaths of condors due to microtrash. That's a big issue that's coming up. I think that you need to have information in the report on the overall mortality rate of condors for all reasons, for everything. Because what we need to have is a global view of the population, what effects are having in the population. What I don't think we want to do is have a myopic view of this so-called bullet-led nexus that people are drawing. Because the other thing I think the question that should be asked is, in relation to microtrash and in relation to other things that condors are ingesting, what are the other possible sources of lead that we're going to see? So in the context of everything else we've heard this weekend, I agree with Commissioner Rogers and Sutton and other ones who've discussed this, that we need to look at a global view of this. We need to look at all the possible lead sources, all the possible contaminants that have come into the system. But also we need to have a complete and accurate picture of all the things that are going on, including the breeding success rates, the problems that they're having with microtrash, and all these other issues. So please take that into consideration and ask the staff to include that information in the report that we're all looking forward to seeing. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
May I ask a question to the department related to what Ed's comments were? I'm assuming that all the additional elements that would contribute to the demise of a condor that Ed is suggesting will in fact be embedded in that report, won't it?
Yeah, we'll provide you everything we can get our hands on.
Right,
as
exactly.
You remember, several years ago, we had a very lengthy presentation, the commission
right.
in San Diego, which kind of caught us up and
right.
you up with all the history, and so we'd be adding to that.
I think Ed is absolutely right about the approach. I mean, in order to be intellectually honest about it, we need to examine virtually all elements of what affects the condor.
Yeah,
he's right.
We love data, and yeah. we'll give you anything we can get our mitts on.
Next speaker, Tom Pedersen.
Good morning, Madam President, members of the Commission. My name is Tom Pedersen with the California Rifle and Pistol Association. Just to reiterate a little bit what Ed said, I think it's really important that we do have good science that can tell us, you know, what the other sources of lead contamination are relative to the California condor population. In that regard, though, because this body only regulates hunting activity, I think it's really important that enforcement receive the necessary resources to be able to measure the level of compliance in that regard. Otherwise, if there's a control area that's established, and I appreciate the comments that were made by the commissioners regarding other upland game species, there needs to be some assurance that that compliance level is accurate and it really does represent something that can be used in a scientific study to measure that compliance level. Otherwise, in regards to the zone with the drop in tag sales for big game hunting and things like that, it's going to be very difficult to measure the actual amount of lead contamination. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
That concludes public comment on item 8. Move along to item 9, receipt of commission informational items. The one thing I wanted to bring up to the commissioners today was the idea of the possibility of the commission joining the California Biodiversity Council. And Biodiversity Council is a group that was formed by I believe the Resources Agency was instrumental in putting it together back in 91. And right now there's 42 members, including 20 state agencies, 12 federal agencies, 10 local governments. It's chaired by Mike Chrisman and the Bureau of Land Management State Director Mike Poole. They meet a couple times a year, and when you look across their membership, which is available off their resources website, it really struck me as a good question as to why the commission is not a member of this group. And from a staff perspective, I recommend the commission joining this group. It would not add significantly to our workload, but they meet about 2 times a year on selected items. They're having a meeting next week on salmon issues, global salmon issues. I can represent the commission at these meetings. I'd like to get a little bit of feedback from the commission on if I should move forward with this. I could bring it as a agenda item for, you know, official approval at our next meeting if you want me to look into that. Oh, my time's up. Sorry.
Well, I certainly support it. John briefed me on this the other day, and I gave him my full support. If the rest of the commission feels so inclined, we can assign John to represent us.
Absolutely. In my experience, professional associations can be really great and terrific opportunities to liaise with our peers. Others can be a total waste of time. So, John, it's you know,
it's up
to you to tell us which one this is.
Right. And the department is heavily involved in this one also. I don't know if Don wants to add in on this at all.
Yeah, we have been involved. John had it right. Resource Agency formed the group. And actually, a lot of the early interaction was in Northeast California, and so I've attended numerous ones as a regional manager, and we attend all of them, at least at the deputy director level. It's a great organization in terms of the council is made up of just a variety of cross-sections of state and federal agencies, but also local governments, and that networking that Commissioner Sutton mentioned is just a really good forum. The meetings are all specific to a particular issue. Like John said, salmon, my experience with them was a lot of public lands grazing issues. So it's a valuable use of a couple times a year for the commission to have a representative there, from my perspective.
The other thing I wanted to add to the commissioners is that I did discuss this with Mike Christman, and he was very, very receptive to this idea of the commission being involved.
John, just a related comment. One of the other professional associations that the commission and the department are involved in is the Wildlife Society. They're going to meet here in California. I guess it's their annual meeting in September. It's the week of the 21st of September. They're meeting in Monterey. I'm hosting a dinner or reception for them at the aquarium. I think it's on the 24th of September, one of those days that week, 23rd or 24th. Just to put it on our calendars, the commissioners are all welcome to that if you can make it.
Thank you, Mike.
Yeah, along those lines, it's a national meeting here in California, which this might only be the second one since they've been doing national meetings in California, maybe the first. It's a pretty rare event, and it's a very, very great event from a wildlife perspective. Okay, commissioners, well, I will have on the agenda for the next month approval to go with the Biodiversity Council. We have one public speaker card for item 9, Paul Weakland. Okay, that moves us to item 10, subcommittee reports and recommendations. 10A, Marine Resources Committee. Do we have one of the chairs who'd like to give an update on the MRC?
We do.
Thank you, John. Craig Schumann, who is our commission marine advisor, is not here today, but I'm pleased to report that he's been very active. He's been coordinating our activities with, in between meetings, with a number of related entities, the Ocean Science Trust, the Marine Protected Areas Monitoring Enterprise, the Joint Committee on Fisheries and Aquaculture of the Legislature, the Ocean Protection Council, and so forth. And I think he's been a real help to our commission staff in becoming more proactive on marine issues. Our latest Marine Resource Committee meeting was held a week ago, April 2nd, in Santa Barbara. Commissioner Richards kindly hosted us. Commissioner Rogers. You guys need to have different names. Commissioner Rogers kindly hosted us.
No, just remember, it's the handsome one.
Thank you very much for that, yes. We met in Santa Barbara. There were between 40 and 50 people in attendance, and I have to say it was probably one of the best Marine Resource Committee meetings we've ever had. We had two agenda items at our meeting. The first was to talk about one of the main projects we have going at the MRC, and that is the evaluation of the performance of the Marine Life Management Act, the state's principal fisheries statute. There is, as you probably will recall, there is a consulting team working on this. Michael Hardy and his team are hard at work under a contract with the Ocean Protection Council. The latest development is that they have put together a key issues document. It's available for public comment. They're breaking their evaluation down into essentially three sections. One is a retrospective look at the performance of the statute and the department and the commission in implementing it. Two is a look at what are the problems that fishermen and other stakeholders have had with the MLMA. And the third section will be a look ahead. What are their recommendations for making the MLMA work more effectively? That issues document, their preliminary scoping document, is on the website. It's opc.ca.gov, and they're taking comments until April 15th. So we have about another week to get our comments in. And we're pleased with the way that's going. We're going to have a lot more opportunities to comment and interact with the consulting team as they go through their review of the MLMA. And, of course, the department, the commission, and the OPC are working hand in glove on that. The other topic at our meeting last week was a review of innovative approaches to fishery management, new approaches that are replacing some of our tried and failed approaches to fishery management. We heard from three different groups, which are doing really interesting stuff. One was a group of students, graduate students at the Bren School at UC Santa Barbara, that are working with lobster fishermen in the Channel Islands to develop more innovative and successful ways of collaborative management there, including, for example, the fishermen themselves calling for the legislature to pass a lobster stamp that would be a stamp for commercial fishing of lobster that would help fund the assessment and possible certification of the lobster fishery under the auspices of the Marine Stewardship Council. So again, it's a very, very interesting effort in a collaboration with graduate students in Hunter Lenahan's lab at UC Santa Barbara and the fishermen's, the California Lobster and Trap Fishermen's Association. The second group we heard from was the California Fisheries Fund, which is a new entity basically created to make microloans to fishermen in the ports up and down the coast to support more sustainable fisheries. And the first set of loans they've made, first set of investments, is in Morro Bay. They're funding fishermen, dockside facilities, and processors, the Central Coast Seafoods in that case. So it's a vertically integrated series of investments to support more sustainable fishing, rebuilding our ports on the backs of sustainable fisheries instead of unsustainable fishing, which we find very encouraging indeed. And so did all of the, I attended the launch of the California Fisheries Fund in the Bay Area the week before, and it was really interesting to hear fishermen, conservationists, processors, and distributors all talking the same language, working together. Finally, we had a presentation from the California Abalone Association that are putting together a framework for a proposed fishing cooperative and co-management strategy in the event that San Miguel, the abalone fishery, commercial fishery at San Miguel Island is reopened at some point in the future. Their work is, again, very thoughtful, very progressive, involving some very smart people from the academic community, the conservation community, the fishing community, all working together to make sure that if commercial fishing for abalone is ever reopened, it's done in a sustainable way, it's done in a way that supports ecosystems and communities alike. So, very, very interesting series of presentations on innovative new approaches to fishery management. The department was represented by Maria Vojkovic, the Marine Region Manager, and we were grateful for her taking the time to attend. And let me just close by asking Commissioner Rogers if he wants to make a comment.
I do. Having been on the commission for a number of years and been responsible for the MRC, way back when, and now with Commissioner Sutton involved, he's really the lead co-chair, if you will. This was by far, I think, the most constructive and interesting and energetic MRC meeting that I've ever experienced. And I want to mention to my fellow commissioners that we really should take heart with what's going on in the marine world with respect to the joining of intellects between the department, the NGOs, and the people who actually know the resource fundamentally the best, and that's the fishing community, some of whom who are represented here today. It is, I believe, a significant, pardon the pun, sea change going on here with respect to starting to trust one another and realizing that the department's funding is for enforcement and science and monitoring is the amount of money is never going to be sufficient to protect the resources and to understand the resources on their own, and therefore the ability for people to access those resources will decline because of the fish populations, if we don't know a lot about them, may start to be ruled off out of bounds, and that's a real problem. So everyone is really understanding that, and they're getting together and starting to trust one another, whereas in the past there was not a lot of trust from both sides. I mean, you had the fisheries biologists in the department being very suspicious of the fishing community and vice versa, and in fact for good reason on both sides. Now they really know one another. They swim transects together. There is a genuine sort of approachment. It's a very different thing that's happening now. The spirit of everyone in that meeting, almost virtually everyone in that meeting, was ebullient. I mean, after the meeting, we all we all got together, or many of us all got together, and sitting around a table, you know, having a cocktail that evening was someone who represented just about every facet of the entire cohort community. I mean, it was remarkable how constructive that meeting was. It was just terrific.
Madam President, let me just close this, our report, by two things. I want to draw the department's attention to one of the bills that we discussed at the MRC was AB 571, which is a bill by Assemblymember Saldana on the lobster stamp. It's one of the first examples I can remember where the fishermen themselves are suggesting that they pay an additional fee in the form of a stamp to commercial fish for lobster, and there's several models, a flat fee or a percentage and so forth, to fund something they want to do. This is not being imposed on them. It's being suggested by them. And that was in the spirit that Commissioner Rogers was just talking about. The other thing, Madam President, is that our meeting last week highlighted something I think is a rising issue, an increasingly important issue for us. We're used to the history of fishery management in this state and this country is one of command and control regulations. What we're beginning to see is the deployment of private capital in favor of conservation. The California Fisheries Fund and a lot of these other innovative approaches depended on alternative means of providing incentives for better fishery management. I find that very encouraging because a lot of what we have tried hasn't worked very well. Nobody's at fault, it's just the way it's worked. And so we need to look for more innovative ways to manage our fisheries. And I was encouraged at the number of people and the amount of work going into finding new ways to help us do a better job.
I completely agree with Commissioner Sutton's comments. I think people need to understand that the end goal of the MRC is to not only improve fishing opportunities both for recreation and for commercial purposes, but to make those opportunities, particularly for on the commercial side, more profitable and more regular, and allow the fishing community on the commercial side to size the assets that they have deployed to be appropriate with the potential income stream from that, so that they're not overcapitalized, and to ultimately, the extent to which we can do this, give them a stake in the fishery and allow them to, in fact, use that stake as part of their estate. I mean, there are a whole bunch of things that are really critically very important, and we're actually starting to line up the NGO support and the environmental community support, the department and the fishing communities, both recreational and commercial in this regard. And this is a real paradigm change. This is a significant paradigm change. But the ultimate result, hopefully, will be far better managed fisheries with actually less pain and strain from the department's perspective, less money spent by the department, because we're probably not going to be in a less money situation. And actually, in my opinion, because of more eyes on the water from the people who are actually stakeholders in those communities, being empowered. And it'll be an infinitely better situation to me. And that seems to be the impression now of virtually all the stakeholders involved.
Thank you for that great report. Sounds like you two were very busy and had a lot on your agenda. Very meaningful. Jim, do you have a report from the Towshire Committee?
Well, I'm going to refer to John Fisher for that report.
Okay.
Thank you. Commissioners, the Towshire Committee met on Tuesday the 7th. That was this week. There were about 30 people in attendance, including many folks that are in this room. The department was very well represented. John McCammon was there, Sankey Mastrop was there, and several other folks in the audience. I see Doug Updike and Eric Loft.
John,
Angie.
Would you mind? We're having a hard time hearing you. Do you mind speaking louder?
I'm sorry.
That's okay. You're a soft-spoken guy.
Is this
guy.
Better now?
Yeah.
Okay. Anyhow, we met on the 7th at the Fish and Games Region 2 office, And it was a productive meeting, a very productive meeting. I wanted to express appreciation to the Chief Deputy Director of the Department, John McCammon, who came and spoke on the department's budget situation. And we spoke at length on that during the afternoon. This is about the third or fourth presentation that we've had on the budget, and I think folks are getting the idea that there are some real budget challenges. And now I hope that the next step can be to move to things that will help to fix some of those problems that are there. At any rate, Commissioner Kellogg was in attendance, and also Commissioner Richard and Executive Director Carlson participated in the meeting. So if there's anything that I'm missing and you folks want to add in and cover up for me, I'd certainly appreciate that. Two things that the Tauscher Committee asked for at the meeting were a list of department facilities, wildlife areas and ecological reserves, a current list that provides for hunting and fishing opportunities and also identifies those ecological reserves and wildlife areas that don't have hunting and fishing opportunities there. And the intent was to look at expanding some of those opportunities where that's possible. A second thing that the committee asked for from the department was a list and a status report on the commercial fishing license fees and permit fees and an update on that. And that was something that the department had prepared back, I think, in 2007. So those items are being moved forward. Those will go back to the Tauscher Committee. There are a number of subcommittees in the Tauscher Committee that will be convened to look at these lists, to take further action on these types of things. And our next meeting, I believe, is scheduled for June 22nd or 23rd, right before our commission meeting. Some discussion of legislation, much of which was discussed yesterday in our commission meeting, and I think that's probably as good a summary as I can provide right now, unless you folks would like to add to it.
Thank you, John.
We have one public speaker card on 10 A and B, Paul Weakland.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. Well, the MLMA was enacted in 1999, but still has not been implemented. Questions since that time have been asked over and over and over again, and no answers. We had to wait and wait and wait to get a marine advisor so that he could be present to answer questions. Now he doesn't even show up to the meetings. But now we understand that the public comment period will be open until April 15th. So it's been open for over 10 years, the public comment period. Yet no questions have been answered yet. Will this end? Will the redundancy stop? Let's see, what can I tell you? Sam Schuchat told me when he was a commissioner that I should go find something else to do because he was sent here from New York, and his backers have their thumb on every commodity that's traded in this country, but they do not have their finger on the pulse of the proceeds of commercial fishing on the West Coast. He was sent here to change that. And the way he's doing it is by buying scientists, creating crisis management, ending the way that we do fishing here in this state. We are changing the ownership from the people and citizens of California to conglomerates, cooperatives, and collectives. This way, the big money can step in and buy these industries. And it is not right. And you are a party to it. And it's tyranny. That is what you are contributing to. That is all.
That concludes public comment for item 10. Commissioner Gustafson had to step away for a second, but we will move to item 11, receipt of federal agencies informational items. We're happy to have Tony Morton with us from NOAA Fisheries.
Good morning, Commissioners. Tony Morton with NOAA Fisheries. Tuesday, American Rivers named the Sacramento and the San Joaquin Rivers as the most endangered watershed in the United States. That follows on the heels of President Obama's signing a public lands bill into law last week that included authorization for federal resource agencies to formally participate in the San Joaquin River Restoration Program. We at NOAA Fisheries have been anxiously awaiting that legislation since October of 2006, when the San Joaquin settlement was approved in federal court after an 18-year legal battle involving the Fryant water users, the Natural Resources Defense Council, and the Departments of Interior and Commerce. The restoration program is intended to provide water and fish habitat in the San Joaquin River from Bryant Dam to its confluence with the Merced River near Fresno, with the reintroduction of both spring and fall run Chinook, hopefully following shortly thereafter. A combined total of about $390 million in federal and state funds, as well as fees to come from water users, will be directed towards the restoration efforts over the next 10 years. So we're looking forward to getting fully involved, along with the department and the other agencies and parties, and working to see if we can restore fish populations to the San Joaquin. Earlier this week, the Pacific Fishery Management Council considered four options for amending the highly migratory fishery management plan and establishing a West Coast-based shallow-set longline fishery targeting swordfish on the high seas, which are those waters that are 200 miles beyond the coast. The four alternatives presented in a draft supplemental environmental impact statement included two forms of limited entry, one open entry fishery, and the status quo or no fishery. All three of the action alternatives would require the use of circle hooks and mackerel type bait, which have been demonstrated in the Hawaii-based fishery to reduce turtle bycatch, and the fishery would be closed immediately for the year if a predetermined take limit of turtles were reached. The council was expected to select one of the limited fishery options, but instead voted for no fishery. I believe that further information will be provided to the council, and the discussion on that topic may resume at their September meeting. As I've stated in previous meetings, NOAA Fisheries would support a well-regulated, limited-entry shallow-set longline fishery for swordfish as something that's preferable to continuing to support imported swordfish that may be taken by foreign fleets without regard to bycatch of turtles and other species. And related to that, as I mentioned last month in Woodland, NOAA Fisheries Office of International Affairs will hold a public hearing this coming Monday, April 13th, at our Southwest Fisheries Science Center in La Jolla at 4 p.m. to discuss a proposed rulemaking concerning the identification and certification of nations whose vessels engage in illegal, unregulated, and unreported fishing. And yesterday, the topic of stimulus funding was mentioned during the discussion on the Smith River. These are funds made available for restoration projects under the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. I guess we shouldn't raise hopes too high for NOAA projects in California, as we received 700 applications for $2.5 billion in restoration work nationwide, and we only have $170 million available to us to distribute. But we should know sometime within the next month or so what projects have been selected and which, if any, of those are in California. Dr. Jane Lubchenco is now on the job as the new NOAA administrator, and we also have a new Secretary of Commerce, who's the former governor of Washington, Gary Locke. No word yet on who our new NOAA Fisheries Assistant Administrator will be yet, but Dr. Jim Balsiger, who's acting in that position, continues to do an outstanding job. And finally, Earth Day 2009 is April 21st, and I wanted to encourage everyone to consider doing something a little beyond the ordinary, perhaps helping clean up litter from a beach or a riverbank, or just go visit one of our California aquariums and learn a little bit about the water cycle or marine resources. That's it for me.
Any questions or comments, commissioners?
Just a question. Tony, I don't know if you know the answer to this, but when are the appointments to the Pacific Fishery Management Council expected? When is that decision? Is there a deadline for those to be for those appointments to be made?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure, but I think it's May. I think it's coming up pretty quickly.
May, okay.
Mm-hmm. I'll find out and clarify that for you.
Great. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much.
We have no speaker card for this one. Item 12, Fish and Game Commission / Department of Fish and Game Workload Planning and Coordination. I added this to the agenda really mainly to tee up a future session on this subject, and was hoping to maybe scope some ideas from the commissioners and potentially the department. Background, remember last May we got together for a whole day with a facilitator to work through this issue. What I'm looking at possibly this year is not having a facilitator back to work with us, but to have a shorter session, maybe attached to a commission meeting, and focus on a couple of selected subjects instead of a wide range across the, and looking at some potential items that kind of coming up with a list right now.
Okay. Commissioners, any discussion on this item? I think John's looking for a little bit of a direction. Do you want to look at a half-day session after a meeting? Oh, I'm sorry. Commissioner Richards?
Well, just, you know, my preference is always that if we can work it around the commission meetings, it's less travel for me, and I think it's, I speak for all of us. So I think it's probably a good idea for us to do it, but I'd certainly like to work it around our existing schedules.
Okay. Any other commissioner comments?
I have a couple of items that I wanted to kind of throw up on the table for you guys to consider. You know, the regulation calendar, we've been hearing updates from Sankey and John Fisher over the last several months, and there are some, it could use, it always could use some more in-depth discussions. That would be one item that is, because that really is the hallmark planning tool between the department and the commission for the whole year's worth of regulatory items. And it can always use fine-tuning, and it can always use, you know, some tweaking to make it more efficient. That's one thing that definitely can be talked, and that kind of, you know, is, goes to the heart of our relationship with the department. Discussion about special briefings is another issue that we could talk about. And I have at least one commissioner, and I know other commissioners have talked about this before, of working our relationship towards being more proactive versus reactive. And, you know, that we always talk, well, in my 20 years in state government, that phrase proactive versus reactive has come up all the time. It's easier said than done. It's easy to say, but I think that it's something we can explore further and actually come up with some solid ways of achieving it, maybe on some specific items, maybe not try to, you know, eat the whole apple with everything we do right off the bat, but maybe pick a couple selected, focused items that we want to really get out in front of as a commission.
John, I think I'm the commissioner that you're talking about on the proactive, reactive. And not that I don't think everybody may agree, by the way, but what I'm not... I don't think we can redo the Fish and Game Department or Commission in a one meeting or one month or one year, candidly. But I do think that for us to be as effective as we should be and to make the time commitments that we all make as valuable as possible, we need to be proactive with the department and say, what is it that's not working? You know, if something's working, if the programs are successful, then, you know, let sleeping dogs lie. But on the things that aren't working, we need to start identifying them and saying, what is it we should be doing as a commission? What is it we should talk about at every single meeting to follow up and say, are we making this work better? And so that's what I'm trying to get to. I don't have the solution to that, but I know in this meeting today, I've already heard at least four times, and because I was counting them today, and I know yesterday I heard a half a dozen times minimum, we don't have enough budget, we don't have enough personnel to adequately do some job correctly. Well, what are those jobs that we should be doing that are not being done correctly that we could start to focus on? And again, we're not going to fix everything in day one, but I think we need to start addressing it and saying, let's start drilling down and saying, what can we do to fix the process?
If I may, mm-hmm. I agree with your comments. I think they're important. One of the things that I would like us to try to do is to work together to improve both the public and the legislators' understanding of what it is that we do, and to focus the extent to which we can on the on the areas where there is friction or lack of information, things of that nature. For example, I mean, there is an example. The department gives a whole host of permits out. You know, whether they're, I don't mean permits to fish in this regard, because that tends to be what we talk about, but permits, for example, stream bed alteration, things of this nature. There's an understanding out there in the world, at least I sure pick up on it all the time, as do legislators pick up on it all the time, that those permits sometimes take months, and that for some reason the department is being lackadaisical or slow or whatever in doing these things. Well, there may be absolutely very good reasons for taking a long time on a stream bed alteration permit. And in fact, there actually may be some issues that, in terms of funding or something, that the legislature can help give more resources to the department, because that is one of those areas that a non-consumptive hunter or fisherman, I mean, just a property owner in downtown Los Angeles, for example, who happens to have a stream running through their property, would be in an angry fashion writing their legislator or calling them up because they've funded them or, you know, and getting them all cranked up about something that, in fact, we could aid them in all sides in understanding the nature of that process. So that's kind of a long-winded way to suggest that I think there are a lot of things that, in fact, that we could help expose and educate both the legislators and the public about our processes. I mean, we have received some letters recently from some legislators that demonstrated a glaring lack of understanding of the Fish and Game Commission and the Fish and Game Department. And that's really not their fault in that sense, the way I think about it. I think it's our fault in not providing an easier way for them to understand the complexity of what the department does and what we do.
Well, I think what I'm hearing from commissioners is there's a wide range of potential topics that you're looking at, John, maybe you could look at, John and I were just talking about our June agenda being somewhat light. Maybe we could look at a half-day session, and maybe what each of the commissioners should do is put together a list of ideas you might have. Let's make it a succinct list. I think what we found last year was it was a little bit overwhelming with our day jobs as well as our commitments here to take action on some of those items and delve into that. It may be in some sort of a session attached to our June meeting. And does that make sense? Okay. Yeah. Commissioner Kellogg?
You know, I was probably the one that wasn't excited about the meeting we had a year ago or whatever it was. And in the end, it ended up being a pretty productive and good meeting. But I hope that this commission doesn't lose sight of what our job really is. And our job is not to run the Department of Fish and Game. If we want to do that, then we need to get appointed a director. Our goal here, in my opinion, and was at the last meeting, was to come up with ways where we can work more in tangent with the department and more cooperative with the department than we had in the past, because there were pretty sour relationships in the past.
Right.
But that not meaning that we have to be a rubber stamp to the department or anything else. But if that's the goal, then I'm in favor of this. But if it's the goal to think that we're going to be telling Don Cook how to do his job, then I'm not in favor of it.
Okay. Well, I don't think that's my intent. I think the other commissioners are looking for ways to assist and support, I hope. Correct? Okay. That certainly is always a concern where we step over into that other role. So we'll make sure we police ourselves on that, Jim, and I think that's wise advice. John, then, can you facilitate some discussion with the commissioners and ask for input on that and look at scheduling something around our June meeting?
Yes, and we will look at a probably a separate venue attached to right in that area of the June meeting dates and
okay.
Go from there.
Great. Thank you.
I have no speaker cards on item 12.
We have two more items to finish out yesterday, so if we can push through.
Yes.
Item 13, receive legal counsel informational items. Deputy Attorney General Deb Barnes.
Good morning, Commissioners. Deborah Barnes, Deputy Attorney General. There are no legal counsel information items that I have to share unless any commissioners have any questions or concerns.
I don't think so. Commissioners, any? Okay. Thank you, Deb.
We have one public speaker card on item 13, Paul Weakland. Is Paul out of the room? We're going to move forward. Moving forward to item 14, new business. At this point, is there any new business from any of the commissioners? Staff doesn't have any right now.
Okay. We'll move on.
Okay. Item 15, announcement of results from executive session. Deputy Attorney General Deb Barnes.
Good morning once again. Deborah Barnes, Deputy Attorney General. There are no announcements required by Bagley-Keene from the executive session of April 8th.
Thank you, Deb.
Item 16, receipt of public testimony on proposed changes to subsection B91.1 of section 7.50 Title 14 CCR related to Klamath Trinity Salmon Fishing Regulations. Please note that the Commission will consider adoption of proposed changes at its April 21st, 2009 teleconference meeting. Scott Barrow from the Department, to my understanding, is going to give us a little bit of an update on this, and then we have public comment. John?
Do you want to, all three of these items following are all related and all part of PFMC, you want to hand them individually, or how would you like to proceed, or together?
From a regulatory standpoint, I'm looking at our analysts. How do we have to separate them out, or can we? Okay, so yeah, we can combine 16, 17, and 18 for efficiency, if the commissioners are okay with that.
Okay.
Let me read all of them into the record. I've already read 16 into the record. 17 is receipt of public testimony on proposed changes of section 7.00 and 7.50 Title 14 CCR. Related to Central Valley Salmon Fishing Regulations, note that the Commission will consider adoption of the proposed changes at its April 21st teleconference meeting. Item 18, receipt of public testimony on proposed changes to Section 27.80 Title 14 CCR related to Ocean Salmon Fishing Regulations. Note that the Commission will consider adoption of the proposed changes at its April 21st, 2009 teleconference meeting. So the three combined. Go ahead, Scott.
And I'll first start with Klamath. I get the presentation for 17 just up ready. First of all, I'll just give you an update of what happened at the PFMC reference to salmon. They discussed the decline of fall fishery report and sent it back to committee for further discussion between the various subcommittees of the commission. I believe you have the draft report, and I'm not going to prepare to discuss it this time. Neil can provide information later if you would like. We also, the STT and the department staff, met to discuss the 650 fall Chinook that were estimated to be taken in the late fall fishery last year. And we came to a conclusion that that estimate, which was based upon using ocean methodologies, using cordwainer tag contribution rates and predictions of effort, overestimated that percentage, that proportion. We're still working on the final number, but the final estimate that will be finalized next year will be something like tenfold less for fall impacts. And also this group met that decided that we could go ahead and allow a fishery in the Sacramento River in the same location that we had in 2008. If we start after November 15th, we will have zero fall impacts. So in addition to also adopting, that's the two things from PFMC. The third one is they adopted the seasons yesterday. The bad news is there is, again, no commercial fishing in the ocean and limited to commercial fishing off of our coast in the ocean and in the river. Now for Klamath, basically the Klamath fall projections for next year will be 40,700 adults returning back to the river. That's a conservation objective. For Sacramento fall, projected return under the seasons crafted will be 122,050. That's 50 fish over the minimum level. So basically what that means for salmon, for
Klamath, is the quota level be at 30,800 adults. And the department recommendations, which will be in your pre-adopt for April 21st, I'll try to give you a feel for our recommendations and show you some graphical maps here so that you'll have an understanding of what we're talking about when we're actually adopting this on April 21st. So again, the quota is 30,800 adults. The department is recommending for the daily bag limit of 3 salmon, of which 2 can be adults over 22 inches, and the possession limit of 9 salmon, of which 6 can be adults for the possession limit. So that covers the updates for the Klamath. I'll get into the ocean right now. So these are the PFMC recommendations. I'll just show you a couple maps. We'll talk about it. First one will be Central Valley. Central Valley recommendation, as again I mentioned earlier, potential salmon season for us is November 16th through December 31st from Red Bluff Diversion Dam to Knight's Landing, the same area that was open last year for 2 last weeks. We're looking at the public options basically have 1 to 2 salmon bag limit. The department is recommending a 1 salmon bag limit, and that'll be in our pre-adopt coming up. All other areas and adversaries for salmon will remain closed for 2009. The ocean, again, they adopted this yesterday for the ocean. No commercial fishing whatsoever in the ocean. A small sport fishery from August 29th through September 7th, 10 days, up in the Klamath Management Zone, which is above Horse Mountain, right above Shelter Cove. That's 10 days for 2 fish per day, 124 inches minimum size. All other areas will remain closed, and we have a 2010 opener set, which will not be part of your package you adopt on the 21st. We're going to deal with that as part of the triennial, because it eliminated having to go out to public notice. But basically, we're hoping we can open up below Horse Mountain, which is right above Shelter Cove again, Mendocino County, down to the border on April 1st. Now that may, if the escapement for Sacramento Fall ends up being less than 122,000, then that will probably be pulled early next year. And that's all I have at this point in time. If there are any questions.
Commissioners, any questions? Comments? Okay. Anything else from the department? Okay, we have 3 public speakers. E.B. Duggan. Did I get that right?
Dugan. That's all right.
That's okay.
It's spelled Scotch, or spelled Scotch, pronounced Irish. That's fine.
And you got a sweet sweet up here who doesn't know either, so.
That's all right. I answer to anything as long as it's not late for dinner. Thank you, commissioners. Madam Chairman, my name is E.B. Dugan. I'm a paid guide, professional guide. I've been a professional guide for going on 19 years for the Trinity Klamath River section. I'm also here representing the Trinity River Guides Association and the In River Sports Fishing Group, as well as I'm a voting member for the Trinity River Restoration Program, and have been in the, reappointed to that again for another 3 years from the Secretary of Interior just recently. I'm here to talk on the 3 different subjects that were just talked about. Basically, we would like to support the department's presentation of 3 fish per day, 2 adults, 9 in possession, 6 adults. One of our concerns is that making the escapement goal of 40,700. Last year we were trying to reach that and we fell far short. We only made 30,950 fish. Consequently, this is approximately 26% below the proposed escapement goal. Our concern is we want to fish, we want everybody to have the opportunity to fish, but we still want to make sure that we make those escapement goals. And last year, we offered to reduce our in-river sport fishing to a goal that would allow more opportunities for all people. We don't like to see any particular group not be able to go fishing. The opportunities, once they disappear or don't go to that opportunity, they will not come back after the second year. And that's a proven fact because I do, like I say, I represent small businesses on the river, and one of them is Del Oma RV Camp, and they had last year people didn't come, so this year they said, well, we're going to wait and see. So he gave their campsites away because he always has a waiting list. We appreciate that, and I will. Am I supposed to speak on all three subjects now?
Yes, please.
Oh, we support the ocean sport fishing of a 10-day, and then also we recommend that you use the November 15th starting date for the Central Valley fishing. We do not like to see anybody not be able to have that, and we're really, really sorry about our commercial fishing brothers not being able to have a fishing season. But we do understand that we're trying to take an endangered, a threatened stock and trying to bring them up to snuff to where everybody will have an opportunity to fish. I do appreciate your time and consideration for this. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And we really appreciate your efforts and thoughts about the other fishermen, too. Thank you.
Well, we want everybody to have an opportunity to be out there and fish.
Thank you. Bob Books.
Commissioners, President Gustafson, Bob Bookie from Johnson's Bait and Tackle.
Sorry.
It's okay. I'd like to go along with the commission's or the department's recommendation for the November-December salmon fisheries. I'd like to keep it at one fish. The fishermen are more than happy to just have one fish as a fish limit. But, you know, we're cutting this back 15 days because they think we're taking some fall run salmon. If we're going to be doing that, I would like to see something done with all of the excess. I like that. I can talk forever now.
I know. I'm sorry. We'll just let it go the other way. I apologize.
I'll be short.
I don't know how to work
I would like something to be done with all of the fertilized excess eggs at the hatcheries instead of throwing them in the dump, that we can do something with those fish. I mean, if we're going to be cut back on the fish we can catch because they're saying they're fall-run fish and then we're throwing the eggs away when they get to the hatchery, that doesn't seem right. So I would like to see something happen with that.
Thank you.
The other thing I wanted to comment on was that it appears that our numbers for the fish to come back this next year are 122,000, which is about double what we had the last year. And we haven't done anything to try and improve our fisheries yet because we didn't start that till 2007. But in 2006, we had extremely high waters in the Feather and the Sacramento Rivers and until June. And which this allowed, I believe, the smolt to get down past the pumps, which are the major problem with our fisheries in the Delta, and get out to the ocean. And so I think this shows that the pumps are a problem, and it also shows that if we were able to flush our fish down with water, I think we would have better results in the long run. Because this was done by non-human hands here. So anyway, I would just wanted to make that comment and thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Yeah. Hmm? George Badowski, E.B. Dugan.
No, we've already done everybody.
So,
just George.
Just George.
morning. Cindy and I came up here 5 years ago because of a salmon season, and we've really enjoyed it. Bought a home, an old home on the Feather River, and got it finished about the time couldn't go fishing. I think now more than ever, we need to continue the spirit of a fisherman for whatever the numbers of fish are or the limits are. I don't care. Well, I do care, but I don't care about the numbers of catch, I guess is what I mean. The idea of just being able to get out there. And these businesses that survive because of things like a salmon season, I think now need it more than ever. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sir, would you come back and give your name again? I didn't hear it very well. Come back and give your name so that
did
we can
I
get
even
it
remember to say it?
No. I didn't hear it very well.
I am George Badashi from Kings County, California.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, George, if you hang on there for just a second. I think it's safe to say it's always dangerous to speak for my fellow commissioners, but I'm pretty sure that your comments are very well taken here. We are saddened on this salmon situation, and we're doing everything we can to continue to allow some fishing. It's one fish, and it's a limited season, but there are even those who question why we're even allowing that. So I think given the situation, what I want you to know is we don't take this very lightly. It's one of the most distasteful things that we do up here, and I think we take this with the highest level of sincerity.
Good, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, commissioners, that moves us to item 19. Receipt of public testimony on tag quota changes, clarifications, and urgency changes for the 2009-2010 mammal hunting regulations. Please note that the commission will consider adoption of the proposed changes at the April 21st, 2009 teleconference meeting. Dr. Eric Loft, he left already?
Yeah, he may have just had enough of this.
The old branch chief never would have pulled a stunt like that, I tell you.
Yeah, he left the job.
We could ask Neil to come up and do it.
Please don't.
Real quickly, as Eric's getting his head together, I did want to bring at least one item to your attention. Last commission meeting, there was some discussion on this muzzleloader change in one of the packages.
Yes.
And there was some very vibrant debate on the issue. I wanted to remind the commission that, at least from the department's point of view, taking no action is not a legitimate choice. The federal government has made it very clear to keep in good standing with them, i.e. funding. We need to do something to accommodate, and the department has two options before you. One is the general magnification accommodation, and the other one is a system similar to the crossbow where through a doctor's prescription we would give that individual a specific accommodation under those muzzleloader hunts. So I just want to make that clear. And if you have any questions, certainly we can talk about it. With that, I'll let Eric. You there?
Thank you. Any questions? Yes. I apologize. I was trying to monitor outside. The muzzleloader issue also, as Sonke mentioned, Eric Loft from the Wildlife Branch again. We have received one comment letter on that from an individual who wants to just have any type of scope allowed for the muzzleloader hunts in California. And, of course, that is the ADA issue that we're dealing with. Just as a point of clarification or information, I think I did a calculation last night, I think there's approximately 625 muzzleloader tags that are issued in California. And I think the success rate for muzzleloader hunting is about 14%, which I believe is higher than the general deer season success rate. with high-powered scopes. So already the muzzleloader hunts are already pretty successful, and that's because they're late-season hunts. So that's all I was going to cover on that particular aspect. As it relates to the general regulations for mammal rights...
Eric, hang on for 1 second.
Yes,
Tell me, you said something there, and this is the thing that I struggle with. You said something about the ADA issue. And I know what the threat is, but what is the issue?
Not being an attorney, and
what's the alleged issue?
Well, I think it's a reasonable accommodation is what they're looking for to comply with the Americans with Disabilities Act. And the argument is that, and I'm going to ask Sonky to weigh in because I know Sonky's written extensively on this. In fact, Sonky, please.
Good punt. A good punt.
This is not the first.
Sonky, I meant no disrespect by asking the wrong person. Please.
No, there are, including my father, who thinks I have some disabilities, but I work through them. Seriously, though, this is an ongoing issue. The department has tried to be extremely responsive when we've had ADA issues come before us, and we've made numerous accommodations in one form or another. In this case, specifically, there was at a federal level a complaint that there are individuals that have sight impairments or disabilities that they felt some states had regulations that did not accommodate their disability. The feds looked at it and requested the states to make sure, since we are recipients of federal funding, that our rules did not in fact discriminate or not reasonably accommodate individuals with sight impairments. The department looked at that request and came up with a couple of options we believe are reasonable accommodations for folks that have visual impairments. And the issue from our point of view, and there are many of course, is that what was brought to our attention is because of sight issues, they were having trouble using the traditional, you know, blade open sights because of focus issues, and requested scopes. The issue for us in terms of accommodation is giving them a sighting mechanism that they can clearly see through would be a reasonable accommodation. Now, when you start getting into multiple magnifications, that's no longer, from our point of view, that goes above and beyond a reasonable accommodation from our point of view. So that was the reason one of the options we presented to you was a one-power scope. Doesn't give them any advantage over any other hunter, but does accommodate this difficulty of focusing near sight on the traditional open sights. And or the other option is through a doctor's prescription accommodating that also. So that's the root of it.
A question related to that, Zonky, if I may. I am just dumbfounded with the federal government's attitude in this regard. Sensitive as I am to disabilities and the needs, where have they said anything about other forms of disabilities in other forms of sport that we regulate, for example, fishing? Or is it the only time they've ever said anything is with respect to sight impaired? Because you can think of a million, I mean, electric fishing reels. I mean, you can, I mean, there's all kinds of things that you could start thinking about here that would be sensitive to people with disabilities who couldn't do this, that, or the other thing that would actually be a real problem for the way we organize and manage things.
You know, Richard, I'm with you on this 100%. I'm really challenged with this. I see this as a big boondoggle that what's a one-power scope, what's a five-power scope, you know. If you put a scope up on top of a muzzleloader, at that point in time it becomes very, very difficult, matter of fact, impossible to tell which is which unless you actually physically stop every single hunter and go look at them. And as I sit here on the commission, I see at least three or four of us that are wearing glasses as sight impaired. And I just think there's other alternatives here that us going down this path is a Pandora's box. And I'm really concerned about it. You know, I think you can go to your optician and get a set of glasses that can allow you to focus on the sights on one eye. And, you know, I mean, there's a lot of different things that can be done here that are not putting a scope on a muzzleloader. They have a very special hunt that is extremely advantageous to them, but you stick that scope up on top of it, it changes the game. Now, a one power, of course, does not. My concern is everything else.
Yeah, and I don't know if the director
has... Well, I just wanted to respond to Commissioner Rogers' question in terms of, you know, is this the first time? I want a couple of things. One is the department is certainly supportive with the ADA, and we have made numerous modifications, just like we do with everything, as we learn new information about how to provide access. We provide mobility impaired access for both fishing and hunting in some areas, and try and make sure that we're accommodating, making reasonable accommodations everywhere. So I think I don't want to couch this as the federal government saying you've got to, because the department takes ADA very serious as well, and you know it is a challenging act, and we've learned over the years as it's being implemented how to deal with some issues and reasonable accommodation. So I don't want to be in a position where we're perceived as trying to comply with the ADA with a, you know, with a gun to our head, so to speak, because that's really not the issue here.
I mean, the goal, and to add to the director's comments, our goal is to include anyone, if we can, reasonably, anyone who wants to participate in hunting and fishing. That's our objective. So, I mean, it's a good thing. The question is what's reasonable, and that's where it always gets kind of touchy. The department believes it has provided two options that it could work with that are reasonable. If the commission has other ideas, we're certainly interested.
And I don't think anybody here is saying we shouldn't be sensitive to that or absolutely be complying. The issue and the challenge becomes what's reasonable and what is it we're going, you know, to reasonably be able to do going forward. So, enough said.
Commissioners, I think our Deputy AG would like to say something on this matter.
Thank you, Madam President. I would also just like to, in this specific instance, I really do hear and understand the concerns raised by the commissioners and by the regulated public and by the department as well. I think everyone wants to make the reasonable accommodations. I believe this specific this instance came out of a specific complaint by an individual to the federal government under the federal ADA, and it was also a complaint that was levied against several other states. So other states are also struggling with how to create the reasonable accommodation under the federal law. I know that the commission and the department take this very seriously. There can be, in certain circumstances, if there's not adequate compliance, there can be a loss of federal funding under certain circumstances. So these are things that I know the commission and the department all weigh in as you go down the regulatory road for reasonable accommodation or on a case-by-case basis for reasonable accommodation as well.
Okay, thank you, Deb. Any other comments or questions? Eric, are you completed, or do you want to cover some
a few more items
that you want to cover?
Let
me just summarize on this point just for a moment. Then, you know, currently the department has two options in here. And then I think an option for next year that I think the commission mentioned last meeting for next year is to consideration of eliminating the special season so we don't have this issue. So that, but that'll be next year. So these are the two options that are noticed now for public comment. Okay.
Okay. The rest of the mammal regulation changes that we have before you that would be adopted at your April 21 teleconference meeting relate to the large mammals, sheep, elk, deer, the black bear. And that issue really there is only one thing that is growing in concern, and that's the black bear hunt in San Luis Obispo County. It is raising some concern with folks out there. Just as some clarification, because there is some misinformation that we are seeing in there. One is that it's being claimed that it's being fast-tracked. This isn't being fast-tracked. If you folks will remember, this came to us nearly 2.5, perhaps 3 years ago. The department said we'd look into it. We collected 2 years' worth of data and survey work to justify this and have put it in and run it through a California Environmental Quality Act process to a negative declaration to document that there is no negative impact of what we are proposing. This additionally is not a hunt that is geared towards population control. We've learned from our bear hunting work over the past 20 years that we're not controlling the bear population with hunting. It continues to increase. 20 years ago, it was perhaps 10 to 15,000 when Don Cook was bear coordinator. Now we're above 30,000 bears statewide is the estimate. And I think as many of us know too, we see increasing issues and problems with bears at the urban interface, Mammoth Lakes area, Tahoe Basin, San Bernardino Mountains. All these areas have increased bear issues and bear problems, and one of the things that you would do here is, one, we most importantly, it's a recreational opportunity by including San Luis Obispo County. There's no reason not to biologically. We anticipate that the bear hunter success will be probably about 10%. It's about 10% statewide. Additionally, it is a good idea to let bears know that people are out there and to have bears become afraid of people. We don't want bears to be friendly. We don't want bears in backyards and in cabins and things like that. And any kind of effort that we can implement as a department to help pursue that reduces our workload of both wardens and biologists statewide. Dealing with nuisance wildlife is one of our growing problems. Bears are leading that charge, along with mountain lions, coyotes, turkeys, and things like that. So this is just another option, primarily, again, recreational opportunity. We expect 10% success. We believe clearly the population can sustain it, and that's sort of our that's our pitch. Actually, Doug Updike is here. Doug led the work on the survey and detail work. If there's any questions related to how we came to the conclusion that this is justified, but that's our position on the San Luis Obispo portion, despite what we're seeing written about on that topic.
Eric, a question with respect to that. You mentioned that you had received a letter or letters. I didn't get whether it was. But how would you characterize the author of that letter? Is that letter coming from an individual or is it coming from an NGO?
It appears we're starting to. It's a big, if you will, an action alert type response is what we're getting.
From what sort of people?
Various internet sources. I don't know them explicitly, the actual source, but some of the local community down there in San Luis Obispo County. It sounds like.
How would you characterize the action alert?
The concern.
Yeah. Is it just a don't shoot anything concern? I mean, what is it?
They range all over. There's been several. I think we've probably received 30 or 40 of those kinds of responses. They range from we don't want you hunting bears. This is ill-founded. You're trying to rush this through. This is not the place to be doing this.
Was there any explanation on the assertion that it was being rushed through?
Not that I recall.
Yeah, because it's completely wrong. Yeah, that person has no credibility, obviously.
There's also a claim apparently being circulated. I'm sorry. The department's proposing lifting all numerical limits to bear hunting. Can you correct that for the public record? That was one of the comments that was received.
What we're proposing to do, and it's related to that, is we're proposing to eliminate the required notification of all bear hunters when the return kill reaches 1,700 animals. What now happens is that once the department becomes aware that 1,700 bears have been reported killed, we are obligated to notify every hunter, every bear hunter who has a tag in the state that the season is closed. Fallibilities of doing that are huge. It costs us several thousands of dollars. They may never get the letter. It may come 2 days before the season's going to close anyway. We view it as an unnecessary action. Absolutely. In part because, as we say, like for every other species, we gauge how many bear hunting tags can be issued or should be issued based on what the success is. We don't do that, you know, we don't treat any other species this way where you wait till the number of animals are killed and then shut the season off. So for all the other large mammals, it's entirely different.
Right.
And that's what we're trying to do, is provide consistency as well, and demonstrated over the past 20 years that really this target is not needed, or that fail-safe mechanism, if you will.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Mike.
No, go ahead, Jim.
I just wanted to mention that this discussion was held with all the different hunting groups at the Altosher committee meeting, and I informed them that I was prepared to ask this commission to consider raising the number of bears at this next go-around, because we had met the quota the last couple of years, and we had done that previously from 1,500 to 1,700, and I would much prefer the option that the department is recommending over just raising the number again. I think that's the right direction to go in. And the committee, day before yesterday, agreed with what the department's recommended.
Okay. Commissioner Sutton?
I just have a question about San Luis Obispo County, Eric.
Yeah.
I fly over that area a lot, and I've seen a lot of changes in the last decade as that county has become more and more developed. People retiring from the Bay Area, going down there, opening, you know, vineyards and boutique wineries and so forth. The area is developing very rapidly. It makes me wonder whether what we're seeing in terms of more bear people interactions is as a result of that, you know, level of development in the area, and the calls to open a bear hunt have more to do with, and I have to admit I haven't looked at this as carefully as I should have. But I guess it's a question for the department. Is the motivation for this hunt increasing bear-human interactions, and to do something about that through a hunt, or what's changed that's led this to come up?
The primary motivation is there's bears there, and we can provide a recreational opportunity to hunt bears. Secondary benefits would be dealing with this kind of issue. It'll help out. We don't know how much, but it should help out in this bear-human interaction issue. We really don't want bears at that urban wildland interface that you're talking about that is developing more, and if we can, whatever we can do to prevent that.
Well, let me ask the question a different way then. Why haven't we had a bear hunt there in the past? If there are lots of bears there and there's an opportunity for recreation, why haven't we had it before now?
I think it's because they just want to field.
Commissioner Sutton, I respond to that a little bit, and I know that Doug's got information as well from the department, but the reason that this come about was we had public testimony from the folks in San Luis Obispo requesting a bear hunt and asked the department to look into it, and they came back and reported to us, and the commission directed the department to attempt to open up bear hunting in San Luis Obispo. So that's why they're coming back to us today with it.
I think also over the past 20 years, we've seen bears expanding their range down into Modoc County, for example, and I think this is also an expansion of range, if I'm not mistaken. So, I think that's all I have, unless there's any other questions.
Don?
Oh, I was just in the question was answered, but I was just going to say black bears is one of the conservation success stories. And if you look at North America, black bear populations throughout North America have increased significantly over time. And as all populations do, they'll cycle. But right now across the United States, we're seeing the Western United States expansion of bears into areas they typically don't use because they're now becoming suitable.
Sankey?
Yeah, I have one more item in the bundle of mammal regulations I'd like to highlight, because you will be hearing some testimony, so I figured I might as well give you some attention on that one. Is that okay?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right, well then I'll draw your attention to the part of the rulemakings that you have that are bundled under the mammal regs, the section 708 changes. This is a section that deals largely with administrative procedures regarding tag applications, drawing procedures. It tends not to be a real sexy section, so a lot of folks don't really pay much attention. And I think that's led to a little bit of our communication problem with our stakeholders, and you'll hear about that from some of the public testimony. So what I wanted to do was really highlight or go over real quickly what the changes in this Section 708 are about. Our draw system, which we implemented now, I think, 8 or 9 years ago, and by the way, I have Tony Straw here as one of the founders of our current draw system, or designers, I should say, and Tony's here to answer any specific questions about the drawing and any of the statistical details. But in a nutshell, our draw system is in our way we make our deer tags available and other big game tags. The purpose is fairness to all hunters and the issuance where demand exceeds the supply. We have a lot of zones where they're popular or there's few enough deer that demand exceeds supply. So the question is, how do you fairly make those tags available to everyone? And that's what led the design of our draw system. And it also depends heavily on letting actual hunter demand for those tags self-regulate the issuance. So when the demand goes up, that demand triggers actions in our system in terms of tag availability and how they're issued. It does provide also preference to customers who did not receive their desired tag prior year. So it's kind of a line system. In other words, if I got drawn for one of my highly desired tags, you go kind of back in line and the people who haven't move in front. It's been very successful. None of you, well, except Commissioner Kellogg, actually, were around before we had this system, and this commission spent an amazing amount of energy having arguments about what's fair. We went through a long process that I personally led through the public and ended up with a system, and it's been pretty quiet. I don't think any of you can say you hear much about this in the last few years. But one of the current changes is we're seeing changes in interest in where people go hunt. And the two key areas that are changing on us right now is the C zones up in Don's neck of the wood, Northern California, and D17 and D12. And what's happening there is there's gradually been increased interest such that they're sold over the counter now. Some people put in for those tags in the drawing, and they're actually sold out before the drawing. So if you put in for that zone in the drawing, they're already all gone. And that's caused some consternation among some of our customers. So what this proposal was fundamentally designed to do was to put some of those, develop a mechanism that would put, when a hunt demand exceeds supply, it would automatically move that tag into the draw system to make it available to everyone instead of people who went over the counter. As you'll hear some testimony today, that does change how hunters have to approach acquiring tags, and there's some concern about it. So I just wanted to highlight that, and once you get public testimony, I look forward to any kind of further discussion about where we might go from here. And unless there's any other questions, that's all we have to add on this for the moment.
Yes, we have 13 public speaker cards, and starting off, we're going to go with 2 minutes per person. Please, if you have something written, hand it in before your time starts, or you're going to lose out on time. Also, make sure you announce your name at the beginning of your talk. Leon Lessica, followed by Randy Richter, followed by Fred Worthley. Please be close to the podium as your turn is coming up. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. I am Leon Lessica from Brawley, and I represent Desert Wildlife Unlimited, a 500-plus member dedicated to the enhancement of wildlife habitat. In D12, we have seen the deer tags go from unlimited to 1,400 to the present 950 tags. In 1979, 50 miles of the Coachella Canal was concrete lined without escape ramps. And because of this, we lost over 200 deer. Since then, Desert Wildlife Unlimited in D12 zone with a fishing game has installed over 70 drinkers with a capacity of 12,000 gallons of water each. This is a very sparsely populated deer herd. But because of these drinkers, our hunter success has increased 6 times. With the increase in hunter success in the last four or five years, we have not seen an increase in tags. Therefore, we feel that D12 Premier Zone classification be postponed for 3 years. Thank you. Any questions?
Any questions, comments, commissioners?
Yeah, I have a question.
Yes, sir.
Why is it you think it should be postponed specifically?
Well, number one, we were not notified, and nobody was in our area, the fish and game local biologists, the game wardens, the local fish and game commission. None of us knew this was coming on, and we took a cut in deer tags from the original, well, not unlimited, but say the 1,400 down to the present 950. And I feel that, you know, being as we went along with this, because we lost a lot of deer in the canal, that we should at least have a chance to negotiate with Fish and Game and see if we can't increase the tags and stay on the draw basis.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Randy Richter, Fred Worthley, Peter Meyer.
Morning. It's a pleasure to be here to speak before you. My name is Randy Richter. I've recently retired after 35 years with Imperial County. I served as the Director of County Property, the Director of Parks and Recreation, and I had the privilege the last 25 years to serve as the Executive Secretary for the County's Fish and Game Commission. As Leon indicated, we had a major catastrophe hit our deer herd in 79. Desert Wildlife Unlimited was incorporated in 1980 as a 501(c) nonprofit organization. The County Board of Supervisors and the Fish and Game Commission has funded numerous projects for water source and habitat development through DWU. During the same time, we have worked with BLM and Bureau of Reclamation on wilderness designation access, on the NECO plan access. We've worked with the military to establish water sources in the Chocolate Mountains, which serves as a nursery for deer and bighorn sheep that propagate throughout the desert. We've seen our herd populations increase 6 to 8-fold at the time that we've been in 11 years of a drought through the last 12 years. Inch and a half of rainfall or less a year, we provide water throughout the year for the deer herd and see them expand not only in numbers, but in territories because the spread of the water sources 5 to 10 miles spread them throughout the habitat. What we'd like to see is some of our information that we've gained over the last 3 decades considered in the tag quota. We have aerial flights, we have radio collaring, we have camera census information that we think would be beneficial in making a determination to either increase the tag quota because the herd has increased or make other changes. I apologize for being up here on such short notice, but when I retired, I attempted to notify the department of my change of address. The notification was sent to an address that has been discontinued, and the Postal Service returned that information. And we didn't learn about this till after your March meeting. We learned about it in mid-March. So I apologize for not having documentation sooner, but it was an error on my retirement and the mailing. So we'd like an opportunity to get an extension and provide input on our information in your making your determination. Thank you today for
Thank
today.
You.
Hang on,
Thank
hang
you.
On, hang on. who is it, Sonke? Are you the guilty party here? And who isn't a guilty party? I'm just kidding. Why wouldn't we accept their information and data? I mean, I'm assuming we would. We'd like to have that. Sounds like it's actually pretty in-depth information.
Yeah, we're always interested in any information somebody's willing to share with us.
Right, and so the request to share the information would be met with open arms. And the timing issue, as I recall, we have to do these modifications. There are certain timelines we have to do that. So what is that? So because they're asking about a delay.
Well, for a context, we have the proposals of mammal regs changes before you. You pretty much have to adopt them by April because our deer seasons, and we have to get all the reg booklets out by the April teleconference. However, I want to point out something. Before you have not only this change in the draw procedure, which is what we consider a fairness issue, you do in your package also have the opportunity to change the tag quota for D12. In your rulemaking is under 360A, for example, the D12 tag range is 100 to 1500. So for example, if the real issue for a lot of these folks is access to tags and they support a tag range increase that would make this issue of moot, moving them into a premium and a draw, simply raising the tag quota would make that problem
right.
go away.
Yeah, and I get the two issues because I think the draw, you know, I'm buying into that. I think that makes sense given the numbers. How long has it been since we, just curiosity, how long have we been at 950?
I don't recall, but it's probably been 6 or 7 years. Okay. It's been a while.
I think it's been a decade. And I'd like to credit Zonke. Without his direction and retired regional manager for Region 5, Fred Worthley, we would not have had the direction and the assistance to build this herd back up to these statistics we have. So they're familiar with a lot of the work we've done, but some of the current information, we, because of our late notification on the address mess up, we weren't able to get our requests and our information to you in a timely fashion to adopt this year's.
All right. And just out of curiosity, if you've been at 950 for 10 years, whatever it's been, 7 to 10, what number is it you think is the right number?
I would say 1,400, 1,500, but I would return it to you and say if you had a deer herd that was recovered 6 to 8 fold and you had hunters wanting an opportunity to hunt that and you could go 1,500, what would you do?
Mm-hmm. Well,
if you're looking for hunter access and the difficult terrain, you're only going to get a 5% success rate.
All right, got it. And would we agree that it's 6 or 7 fold increase in the 10-year period?
I couldn't say that. I think what's important to recognize is that in your tag range, 100 and 1,500, it's based on the department's knowledge, we're saying that's an acceptable range of tag quotas.
So you're saying 1,500 is acceptable.
It's an acceptable range, and some of these very gentlemen can tell you, D12 is not a place you go pick up your gun and your camp gear and go deer hunting. There's only a handful of individuals in the world that really can hunt there reliably and consistently. It's a very difficult zone. So what I'm saying is you can let more hunters out there. They'll have a great time hunting, but odds are they're not going to do very well.
Yeah, that's right. Well, average. That's no...
So but we
it's
have
about,
a hunting.
It's about going hunting.
It's not shooting, it's hunting.
Exactly.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Fred Worthley, Peter Meyer, Ron La Rochelle.
Good morning, President Gustafson and commissioners. There have been several questions here that... kind of precluded my comments. I'm a retired regional manager of the California Fish and Game, retired in Southern California, retired in 1994. I was also active in Colorado River issues, and I'm a life member of Desert Wildlife Unlimited. Very briefly, I think Desert Wildlife Unlimited and the Department of Fish and Game have had an excellent and long-standing and relationship and developing recommendations and developing fish and wildlife resources in the lower desert. I think we would like to continue that relationship. In fact, I know we would. I would recommend in this case that the department defer a tag quota system, a tag drawing system, and let everybody work out, locals at the Department of Fish and Game, local biologists, work out a reasonable program that will both benefit and be able to be sustained by this resource as well as increase hunter opportunity. Now, I've heard a couple of questions about, and Mr. Malstrup said, hey, we can change the tag numbers and raise them. I think that's an excellent option. I was not aware that the commission was able to do that this year given the short time frame, but if they are, then I think that option needs to be considered quickly. I heard a question about how long the 950 has been in.
probably at least 10 years. It's been quite some time. Mr. Malstrup is absolutely accurate. It is a difficult place to hunt, and if you don't know what you're doing, you're just going to have beautiful sunrises, beautiful sunsets, and lots of stars.
So, Fred, let me just be clear. If we were to look at a large, going to the 14 or 1500, you'd be okay with not deferring this?
Or are you making sure I understand? Are you suggesting that we go to a lottery, but with 1400 or 1500?
Well, I guess that was one of the options that Sankey was saying, is that we could expand.
Let me ask it. Okay. To the other side, would the department be okay with deferring this until we had?
That's a fair question. The issue is, by deferring it, you will continue causing this problem where hunters will be applying for a tag in the drawing that is sold out before the drawing, and they will be basically throwing away one of their choices. That would continue for another year. That is certainly your prerogative and a choice.
The department's raised a good issue here, and the lottery resolves that immediately. I think that the stakeholders are raising a good issue here on the numbers.
The numbers.
I'm not hearing any debate by this. Matter of fact, what I heard Sankey say was 1500 is an absolutely acceptable level from the department standpoint. So,
I'm just asking the constituents whether they find that acceptable as an alternative here. Yeah.
It's the best we can do.
Yeah.
That's the range.
Can I suggest real quick while we just look? And Fred, you guys might know it's how many applicants we received last year, and certainly for this zone.
How many we received?
Yeah, in other words, the equitability issue by raising the tags, I want to make sure that we don't, I want to be able to address that. Is that clear? In other words, how many people applied for it with their deer tag and then couldn't get it because it sold out?
I'm sorry, I'm
misunderstanding. We have somebody who can answer that question.
I don't.
Yeah, he's going
to. Yeah, I'd like to answer this in two parts real quick. I'll have Tony. He in his hands has all the magic numbers. But two, I want to make it clear, under the current system we're proposing, the criteria, if the quota was raised above what the current demand is, in other words, supply exceeded demand, this hunt would not go into the drawing. So that's why the quota is significant. With that, I'll let Tony give you the facts.
Okay.
And before I reyield the microphone, I think that's what we'd like to see, is that the quota be above the demand.
Yes.
Okay.
And so however we get there, I think would be to our benefit.
Okay,
thank
great.
You. Okay.
Good morning, commissioners. I'm Tony Straw. I'm a systems analyst with the Department of Fish and Game, and among other things, I oversee the drawing application. Because D-17, D-12, and C-zone, the other one in here, are not currently lottery zones, we issue them upon request. So there were 950 tags for this hunt, and we issued all 950 on request as fast as people could ask for them. Because of that, every application that comes in after that point in time is just marked down to secondary choices, refunded, or returned to customers. So I don't really have fixed statistics beyond that. I did want to make a quick clarification, though. Moving these into the draw is less of an issue of that the people who apply in the draw don't have access to them. It's that it's not fair access when you have when you have maybe a couple thousand people interested in 950 tags, and it's first come first serve when there's nothing to control where that first come first serve occurs, what point in time. It's just when you come to a fish and game office or mail in an app, as soon as it's received, that tag is issued. By putting them in a lottery, you get a very fixed date where everyone has till this very specific date to get an app in, and they're all considered equally in a lottery, and the following year, non-winners get preference over winners from the previous year. Thank you.
Real quick follow-up, though, on Tony. You just said that you don't know how many people want what the demand is, and then someone a minute ago said, can we raise the quota above the demand?
doesn't jive in here.
What data I have that was supplied by Tony is both D12 and D17. The quota in D12 is 950 currently, and D17 it's 500. And we are getting that and just above number of applicants before the drawing. So they're right at that point where it would trigger the demand exceeding the supply. And that's why this is coming before you, and the C-zone's the same situation. So we don't know what's going to be this year, but the trend has been increasing on both of those. So we would expect, all else being the same, that this rule change would push these two zones into the drawing. One solution is by raising the quota, it would prevent that from happening, at least in the near term.
The current regulation would put them in the drawing this year, and if the increase in quota meant that there was less demand, not significant enough demand, the following year they'd automatically, by this regulation, fall back to first come, first serve. Okay. So it's a self-regulating, so we're not coming to you every year to say these zones should be in, these zones should be out. It's essentially to make it self-regulating based on demand.
Sunky, I remain confused about the 1,500. If 950 has been in place for a decade, and over that period of time, the herd has increased in D12 sixfold, then why hasn't the quota increased sixfold to 5,000 some odd animals?
Well, and some of the gentlemen here may want to...
In other words, upon what criteria is this based? I'm now very confused as to how you set the quotas.
Yes, there are several... Fundamentally, we have several ways quotas are set. It's not all the same. We have some zones where the demand and the interest in what the management objectives are, for example, X5B, one of our more premium zones, we're looking for quality bucks. You'll often hear that term. People want some large, old, well-antlered animals. To do that, to achieve that kind of animal, you have to kill them less frequently. Some have to get old enough. So we restrict the quotas significantly where we are actually managing for a product. There are other zones, a lot of the D zones, where that's not the management objective. The management objective is letting a reasonable number of people out there to go have fun, and a certain small percentage, if they do everything right or get very lucky, will take home a deer. We're not managing for a particular product, so to speak. So there's a different strategy between those two. D12 has some serious history on quotas. I was dragged down, I don't remember how long ago, to El Centro, where the demand was that we radically reduce the quota because a lot of hunters down there wanted a higher quality buck. In other words, they wanted to go into buck management and wanted a product, which was larger antler deer. And during that debate, I explained to them the only way you can really do that is by killing fewer of them. And to do that, you would have to cut the quota so low, because you'd have to take Leon out of the woods and Fred Worthley out of the woods to avoid having those deer killed. The quota would be down around 50, 100. And the constituents at that meeting said, whoa, 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 that's not what we want. So we all went home and left it be. So it's a balancing act. In D12, it's a balance between opportunity, access, and trying to get some level of quality that folks want out of it. Zones like D12 are very difficult to really pin down because there are so few individuals that can actually go kill these animals. And to affect change on what gets killed, you have to send those guys home. And so you end up with this gentleman's agreement about what's a reasonable number. Our quota will not impact that deer.
What's a deer license cost?
What are we up to now?
It's about $25.
$25? That's a bargain.
That's on top of a hunting license. So.
Yeah. Yeah, it's quite a bargain. You can have a lot of fun out there.
Yeah, that's too
cheap. And we encourage you. So, on another point, because apparently I'm a little confused too, and Tony triggered a thought here. And this is a concern now to me, too, is the way this regulation in 708 is structured, it's based on last year's data. So what I think I'm hearing Tony say, if you adopt 708 as worded, because D12 and D17 quote, a demand exceeded supply, it would automatically put them in the draw and they wouldn't get pulled out. If you raise a quota, it wouldn't get pulled back out again until the following year. So that changes our strategy here to resolve this, I think. Did I get that right, Tony?
That's true. It would leave them in the drawing, and then we'd have to see what demand was the following year, which is not necessarily a bad thing, because even you, we don't know that there isn't 1,500 people interested in more than 1,500.
Therefore, I would like to add a third option or something for you to consider. If you do not want to put D12 into the drawing for this coming season, you would have to, and I think the commission staff has confirmed this, one option would be is to do a no change for D12 and or D17 and let the rest ride and then come back to this next year. In other words, a no change for those two zones. And we could come back with a combination of tag quota increase or whatever, but it sounds like because of procedure and the way the rule is set up, even if we raise a quota, we would trigger for next year or this coming year at least into the drawing. Did I make that sense at all?
Yep.
Okay, I confused myself there.
I have one more question for you, guys who are into this, because I don't shoot deer and I don't.
So we want to hear you, but okay.
I'm not really sensitive to the dynamics here. It would seem to me that the idea of increasing the quality and making sure the bucks are huge is almost an elitist idea in terms of comparing that against the idea of expanding the hunting opportunities for several thousand people where they wouldn't get to do this. And what is the Fish and Game Commission all about? Is it about increasing hunting and fishing opportunities, or is it about ensuring trophies?
I think it's both, is the honest answer. I think that's what Sankey was saying earlier. There is some habitat, Richard, that is more sustainable to larger animals. And it would be appropriate to manage those and to allow those animals to mature. And in this area, what I'm hearing is a pretty healthy stock and difficult to have success in anyway. So we're going to give the people the opportunity instead of, and then those who are going to be in a little more different terrain, which is going to be a rougher terrain.
Yeah, I understand the logic. I don't necessarily buy into it. I believe that we should, the extent to which we can, as a commission and as a department, enhance opportunity. The extent to which the biology supports that.
I think you're both saying the same thing. A couple things to point out. One is, like in an ecosystem management, diversity is a good thing. And our deer herd plans, which we have deer herd plans for every herd in the state, have been developed in a forum that allows the public to provide us with where they want diversity in terms of that quality versus opportunity. So those herd plans sort of drive that earlier decision. But I think what we've found over time is there's a demand from the sporting public for both, and that's a legitimate demand on both ends. And one of the reasons we have a proposal in front of you, the C zones, is that's what we actually did there. We combined several zones to provide significant opportunity. So somebody could go from C1 to C2 with the same tag and have that flexibility. Because for some folks, it's extremely important just to get out. Other folks, like the folks we're talking about here, like to punish themselves when they're out and hunt and some just...
No, I understand.
So I think we're bound by those deer plans and commission policy to provide that diversity. And I
understand that. What I feel... and I feel it viscerally because we get letters all the time from anti-hunting people and things of this nature. To me, to protect the future of hunting in the state of California, as much as we can, expanding the opportunity to hunt. And therefore, having more people out there in more families, in more communities, having had a very satisfactory, if not wonderful, experience, whether they got it or not, for those of us who hunt, you almost have as much fun being out there not getting anything as you do getting something. It's the same thing with fishing. It's not all about catching. It's about fishing. It's about being out there. And I think we do a better service to the overall hunting community to have people in the wild having that wilderness experience, having that hunting experience. So my vote will always be to increase hunting opportunity as opposed to restricting it from some other perspective, because I think that's the larger threat to the ability for people in the state of California to hunt at all.
Commissioner Rogers, if I could ask, Fred, I saw you stand up, and I think we kind of cut you off before. We've talked about a few options here, and I'd kind of like to hear, if you don't mind being a spokesperson for your group there.
I'm pleased to be invited back. I was hoping I could impose myself. Briefly.
Hey, those years of service count for something.
We have Desert Wildlife Unlimited, Department of Fish and Game, and me as a sort of in-between retired, have the same goals, I think, as the commission does. One, make sure that the resource is always there. Two, make sure that the opportunity, hunting or fishing, to enjoy that resource is always available. With that said, I think that we would be pleased to take the suggestion that Mr. Malsup brings up, leave the current hunting regulations, the tags, as they are for the 2009 season, and give the Department of Fish and Game, its field staff, the local folks, Desert Wildlife Unlimited, County Fish and Game Commission, the opportunities to work out what we consider and a reasonable way to both maintain that resource and provide additional hunting opportunity and come back to you through the department next year. And it's my understanding that next year is, I think the term was an on year for looking at all mammal regulations. So if you think that's an appropriate action and it fits with our discussion today, then I think that's how then we would be happy to see that. See it go that
Fred,
way.
I think it.
Thank you.
I think it fits with my sense of.
Pardon me?
I think what you just said fits with my sense of my concern.
I hope so. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, any other questions that either of the three of us can answer?
No, but thank you for being here
and being
patient through this discussion.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
And sorry for the mix-up. You know, that happens when you retire. You put your address somewhere.
We have about 10 other speakers. Peter Meyer, Ron La Rochelle, Josh Brones.
Good morning. My name is Pete Meyer. I'm an aspiring outdoor writer. I live in Placerville, El Dorado County, and I hunt bear with hounds. I'm here today as an individual. My concern is being that bear season closure letters have only been sent in two of the last six seasons and have been deemed an unnecessary expense. Then why not put the entire burden of responsibility on the hunter to call the 1-800 number or check the web page for a season closure and eliminate the letters? In this era of shrinking budgets, our wardens need all the financial support they can possibly get. By removing the in-season bear harvest quota, anti-hunting groups have stated that California will, due to hunting lobbyist pressure, allow the unlimited free-for-all slaughter of bears. Well, hunters know that not to be the truth, and that the bear population can accept a modest increase in the harvest without any adverse effects. Therefore, I urge the commission to consider the alternative to the proposed project. Let's keep the in-season bear harvest quota, raise it to 1,900, eliminate the letters to cut costs, and let hunters take more responsibility for and a bigger part of bear conservation. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments.
Ron La Rochelle, Josh Brones, Dan Tischner.
Thank you. My name is Ron La Rochelle. I'm from Pine Grove, California, and I'm just representing myself and my fellow hunters. I've been hunting in California for probably 20-some-odd years. We hunt in the C-zone. And I more or less have a couple questions and a couple opinions. My first opinion or my first thought was the method of notification on this particular issue, changing C to a draw only. And the only reason I found out about it was another fellow hunter of mine. I agree with the need for conservation and the regulatory aspects of the C zone. And I'm all about fairness and the demand and meeting that demand. I know it's tough. I was Joe procrastinator last year myself, and I didn't get down to DFG until almost the last day. So normally I'm a little bit more effective than that. But so I'm all for the draw. Does this draw also, if C zone goes to draw only, does it put you back on the point system the following year? Where does the point system play? Does it turn to like a premium hunt area, or how does that change it?
I like this. It's automatically premium, so it goes in the draw. It would automatically go into the draw here, and anybody who applies in the draw for their first choice, so anybody applying for C who does not get that tag earns a preference point for the next year, and then they have advantage over everybody without preference points.
So kind of like the same the way the X zones are handled right now.
Exactly.
Okay. So my only other concern, and I know I'm running out of time, is that the method of notification and the concern on the negative impact that it'll have on the families that have already made plans for this year. Maybe take another look at it. Thank you.
Josh Brones, Dan Tischner, Jeff Kuiper.
Good morning, members of the commission. My name is Josh Brones. I'm here today representing California Houndsmen for Conservation, an organization that represents the hound hunting community in the state of California. We would like to offer our endorsement of both aspects of the proposal of the department to modify bear hunting regulations, both for the opening of San Luis Obispo County for the hunting of bear, as well as the removal of the obligation of the department to notify bear hunters of the season's closure. I would like to address the latter rather than the former. We believe that as hunters, we are encouraged by the opportunity for greater days spent afield in the pursuit of bear, and that it would provide a cost-cutting measure for the department, and that they would not be required to undergo the expense or the effort of notifying hunters that the season was closed due to the quota having been met. However, it is more incumbent upon us as hunters to fulfill our primary role of conservationists and to continue the legacy of being the guardians of our wildlife resources, that we consider those as secondary priorities. And we could not in good faith support the department's proposals had they not arrived at that proposal through sound science. We believe that they have done so, that the data that they've collected does support the elimination of the notification of the closure of the season. As previously indicated, the quota has only been met for two of the last 6 years. And in those 2 years, and in years previous where the quota was met, the number of bear reported taken did exceed the 1,700 just due to the lag from the notification to the submission of the tags. One ecological aspect that I would ask that you guys consider is the compensatory or cumulative nature of bear mortality. Essentially, what this means is that there's going to be a total mortality on any given year, whether or not it's natural or human-induced. And the greater the human-caused mortality, the less the natural mortality. But ultimately, that total mortality would not be exceeded. Thank you.
Dan Tischner, Jeff Kuiper. Ed Worley.
Good morning, President Gustafson, members of the commission. My name is Dan Tischner. I'm representing North Central California Houndsmen. We are in support of the bear hunting regulation changes as proposed by the department. We believe they're quite consistent with the data that shows an expansion of the bear population and expansion of the bear range. I'd like to point out that by expanding the hunt into San Luis Obispo County, we'll be able to acquire the bear age data from the teeth that are collected from harvested bears, which is one of the sources of data that's enabled the department to keep very close watch on the bear population and ensure that it is in good health. And we're very happy that the bear population has expanded, and we would hope that everyone interested in this issue would share that that happiness. Thank you.
Jeff Kuiper, Ed Worley, Sonny Hammonds.
Good morning, Madam President and members of the Commission. I'm Jeff Kuiper, the Executive Director of Los Padres Forest Watch. And I had to drive 5 hours to get here this morning, and I expected 3 minutes, but I'll try to condense it down into two in the interest of time. Where Forest Watch is a nonprofit organization working to protect the Los Padres National Forest along the Central Coast, basically from the Big Sur Coast all the way down to the L.A. County line. We're supported by more than 800 members throughout the state of California, and I'm here today mainly to discuss the proposal to expand bear hunting into San Luis Obispo County. It's one of the counties that contains the Los Padres National Forest. And allowing bear hunting in that county, that activity will primarily occur on public lands in the Los Padres National Forest. That's why we have a interest in this proposal. And really, the essence, I think, of my comments can really be squeezed down into two main issues. Number one, we heard it earlier this morning, sound science. The other one, making sure rules are enforced. First one, the sound science issue. I hope everyone in this room can agree that decisions affecting our state's wildlife populations need to be based on strong science. And to put forth this proposal to expand hunting into San Luis Obispo County, the department has prepared a negative declaration. And in that negative declaration, they conclude that this proposal will have no significant effect on bear populations in San Luis Obispo County. And it's really hard for us to even begin to analyze that conclusion, let alone agree with it, because despite repeated requests, the department has failed to provide us with access to the studies and other documents cited in the negative declaration. I distributed a letter that we sent to the department regarding this issue, and I'll leave it to you to read it in the interest of time. But really, what we're asking for, what it comes down to, is the department needs to provide all the supporting documentation it relied on in preparing the negative declaration. They need to make those documents available to the public in the county that this proposal is affecting. That is a requirement of CECO Guidelines Section 15150. And so we're requesting that the department make those documents available and that an additional 30 days worth of comment is provided so that really we have a chance to look at those 900-plus pages of documents and provide your commission with meaningful comments to move forward on this. So really, in conclusion, I guess why I'm here this morning is really to ask your commission to direct the department to comply with CEQA by providing not only us but the rest of the public as well with access to the supporting documentation, and also to provide a 30-day comment period after that compliance is achieved. Also, I did bring with me this morning a few other documents that I'll hand over to Mr. Fisher as well. And for the record, I'd like to point out that the chair of the Board of Supervisors
Sir,
of San Luis Obispo
you're
County.
You're out of time. Can you just wrap up, please?
Yeah.
Okay.
One more sentence here, and I'll be done.
Okay.
The chair of the Board of Supervisors has of San Luis Obispo County has come out opposing the expansion of the bear hunt into San Luis Obispo County. The San Luis Obispo Tribune, the county's main paper, the editorial board has written an editorial against the expansion of the bear hunt. And I've provided you with copies of other articles that talk about some of the community's concerns as well. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, Ed Worley, Sonny Hammonds, Bill Gaines.
President Gustafson, members of the commission, Ed Worley with the National Rifle Association. I want to echo Commissioner Rogers' comments about the very important thing about the common man out there. A lot of people talk about trophy hunting and game hunting. It's very important for our members, who are the common man, to be able to have the hunting access and hunting resources. We want to echo and thank the staff for coming to the Tasher Committee meetings. We've talked long and hard about different issues and game resources. We want to recommend that you do adopt the regulations to save the money when it comes to the notification for the bear hunts. It is the responsibility of the hunter to be notified, and but it's also in the time of budget crises, which we have here in California. Any monies that we can save in the fish and game to go into resource management and conservation would be very critical. So I'm not going to take any more of your time, but we just echo the recommendations of your staff commission and look forward to work with you in the future.
Thank you. Sonny Hammonds, followed by Bill Gaines, Tom Pedersen.
Good morning. Sunny Hammonds from El Dorado County, Madam President, Board. I would like to thank all of you, and, you know, our expenses are very much for everyone, especially now. By mailing all these notices out to us hunters all the time saying bear season is closed is a little ridiculous. Most of the time we don't get them until after even the season is closed. Also, we're out there hunting. Bear season is closed. We sometimes come home. We've been out there in the woods. We can't call in. Cell phones don't work up there. We call in when we're home. Fine. We're up there 2 or 3 days. The season has been closed. We have no way of knowing. We come down. We get our bear validated. The game warden says, do you know that the season has been closed 2 days ago? They're great about it. They don't give us a really hard time, but it makes it very difficult. So the problem is, like you say, to solve it is extend the time. Keep it open. It's the best way for everyone. No one gets in trouble. Everybody's happy. And that takes care of the finances, the people, everyone. Thank you very much.
Bill Gaines, Tom Pedersen, Dick Dasman.
Madam President, members of the Commission, Department staff, my name is Bill Gaines. I'm president of the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance, and I'm pleased to be here today to support the opening of bear season in San Luis Obispo County, as well as the elimination of the notification of the quota being reached. This is not a last-minute decision by the Fish and Game Commission. This has been fully vetted through the regulatory process. It has undergone full environmental review. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, opening a bear season in San Luis Obispo County is fully supported by science. There are no public safety issues that I'm aware of. In fact, I think the argument could be made that this would be beneficial to public safety, considering the increase in conflict between bears and humans. And there are a variety of checkpoints in place on an annual basis that the Department of Fish and Game goes through to ensure that the bear populations are healthy throughout the state. Bear populations are 3.5 times statewide what they were in the early 1980s. And if there's any game species out there that warrants an increase in hunting opportunity, it would be bears. We strongly urge the Fish and Game Commission to support the department's recommendation of opening bear season in San Luis Obispo County. And we also strongly urge the commission to support the ending of the notification required for the quota being reached as well. Thank you very much.
Tom Pedersen, Dick Dasman.
Madam President, members of the Commission, Tom Pedersen representing California Rifle and Pistol Association. I'd just like to reiterate support for the opening of the bear season in San Luis County. It's biologically sound and will provide greater opportunity for hunters, and I think that's you know, in the interest of everyone. Secondly, I'd like to comment on the aspect of the one-power scope for muzzleloaders. I realize the department and the commission struggle with a compromise between expanding technology and limiting that particular type of arm. But it has been addressed before. The ADA issue came up relative to archery equipment when the department recommended and the commission approved the use of a crossbow for those individuals that had physical disabilities that required some other device. I know in other states they've used other options sometimes. For instance, in Oregon, I think they looked at a cocking device for a standard bow rather than a crossbow. But with the loss of potential funding for the department because of this potential ADA issue, I think it's a good compromise and something that everyone could live with. Thank you.
Dick Dasman is our final speaker on this issue.
Good morning. I'm Dick Dasman, president of Royal Grande Sportsman's Club. I was the perpetrator of the bear interest in San Luis Obispo County some 3 years ago. I want to thank this commission, current commissioners and former commissioners, who listened to our suggestion of including us in the statewide season. And I want to thank the department for following through on this with their 2 years of study. Delay tactics of certain groups calling for more postings of the bear study at local public arenas are unnecessary. Those who were interested have had plenty of time to research it, as I have. Many of the complaints I have seen seem to come from misinformed sources who don't understand the department's checks and balances already in place. Left in the hands of the department's professionals, I'm sure the bear population in California, including San Luis Obispo County, will continue to thrive. I would recommend that the commission accept the department's two proposals. And as a side note, I'd like to thank the department for their extended education program that they have. I attended Lieutenant Lehman's advanced training clinic on bear hunting in Diamond Springs a couple of weeks ago. It was very informative. I would suggest that the people who aren't informed on this issue attend those clinics, because I found out a lot of information about the checks and balances within the department from that meeting. And I also included a letter, which you will get if you haven't already received, from a longtime educator in San Luis Obispo County in favor of the season as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Thanks for all the public comment on this. This is agendized for a teleconference on April 21st. There was one letter we received and one comment related to a CEQA issue, and I wanted to make sure the department was aware of that and felt it was addressed by the department. Okay.
Yes, the department has received a letter.
Okay. Thank you. Any other comments, commissioners, or questions? Okay. We'll look forward to action then on the 21st on these matters.
That moves us to item number 20, receipt of public testimony on proposed changes to Section 124, Title 14, CCR related to halibutrol. Please note the commission will consider adoption of the proposed changes at its May 14th, 2009 meeting in Sacramento. Did the department have any updates, Sankey, on this?
No, commissioners. As the department told you last time, we just made some minor adjustments based on conversations with the fishermen and enforcement to make some clarifications on some definitions. Other than that, there's been no change.
We have one public speaker, Mike McCorkle, who cooks a mean halibut, we learned a couple
President
weeks ago.
President Gustafson, members of the commission, my name is Mike McCorkle from Southern California Trawlers Association. I would like to thank the commission, and I would like to thank the department, and especially senior biologist Paul Riley, who got in the middle of three groups of people that speak a different language. I speak fisherman, he speaks biology, enforcement speaks enforcement. That was a problem with coming to a good decision that everybody could agree with, which we did. I think as written, everybody supports it now, and it's a good definition. I'd also like to tell you about what's been going on in the halibut trawl fishery this last, since the first of the year, and the economic downturn. All of our members are still surviving, just barely, but we're surviving. One of the things that happened to us was that Asian live fish buyers came in with some nice stuff they call halibut, but it's called by the department a bastard halibut. It's a weird-looking little fish. It's flat, and it lays there in a tank. And he brought over 10,000 pounds in, put it on the market at $1 a pound less than our buyer was paying us. So our price went down $2.50 a pound to us. And we're living with that now. The rumors are that this fish is almost gone off the market and that this buyer lost a lot of money doing what he did, and we won't see any more of that, hopefully. But it just shows how this farm-raised fish coming into a local market like ours can affect it. Maybe one other little point is the MLPA process that's coming along now. We're down to 44% loss of our fishing area in the halibut trial grounds at this time, which is, we can't survive on that because you've got to include marine mammal predation on top of that. But that's only what's going on right now. As a stakeholder in the Southern California MLPA process, I got programmed to think positive. So I'm thinking positive that this will come out okay for us and we'll be able to keep fishing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
We have no other public testimony on item number 20, and they'll be back in front of the commission on May 14th. Item 21, consideration and possible adoption of proposed changes to subsection B178 of section 7.50, Title 14, CCR-related Silver King Creek sport fishing regulations. I don't know if there's any changes. Commissioners, there's no changes from the department's perspective, and we do not have any public speaking cards on this issue. I have a proposed motion from staff when you're ready.
Okay.
Proposed motion from staff is that the Fish and Game Commission, pursuant to the provisions of sections 200, 202, 205, 215, 220, 240, 315, and 316.5 of the Fish and Game Code, and to implement, interpret, or make specific sections 200, 202, 205, 206, 215, and 316.5, hereby amend subsection B178 of section 7.50, Title 14, regarding Silver King Creek sport fishing regulation as recommended by the department. Motion and a second.
Do I have a motion?
So moved.
Second? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you. That puts us to item number 22, consideration and possible action related to the request of James L. Buchel for the commission to amend subsection B91.1B2 of section 7.50, Title 14, CCR, related to exemption to general area closures on the Klamath River, which allows the use of handheld dip nets by the Karuk Indian tribe at Ishi Pishi Falls. I don't believe the department, Sankey might have a little kickoff, and then we have 11 speaker cards.
Yeah, the department, just so it's clear where the department sits, we recommend you reject this request until the department has a time or chance to thoroughly research the issues.
And we have public testimony.
We have 11 public speakers. Mike, did you want to ask a question now, or?
No, that's fine. I'm happy to wait.
Okay. Yeah, and people have waited a long time today to talk to us, so appreciate your patience. Okay.
Now we are going with 2 minutes per person on this item. We have James Buchel. Dane and Nickel said they cede their time to Mr. Buchel. Is that correct?
That's my understanding, and okay. It's my understanding that Mr. Frank Church will also cede his time.
3 minutes. But we cap the ceding to a total of 3 minutes. So you have 3 minutes, sir.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Madam President. I would say that 3 minutes is not enough here. This is a serious petition, and I would also say that you have considered item number 16, which is an amendment to these exact same regulations, the very subsection, 91.1. And it's not clear to me how the commission can lawfully segregate our objection to Section 91.1 off into its own universe and not really address these issues now in a timely fashion. My name is James Buchel. I represent the New 49ers and several other 14 organizations who are petitioners. The New 49ers have about 2,200 members. There are thousands of other members. This all comes down to Fishery Management 101. You do not allow people to fish below or in waterfalls because it's easy to catch the fish. You can catch as many as you want, as fast as you want, and it's not sportsmanlike at all. So Ishipishi Falls is closed. But there's an exemption, and the exemption is for members of the Kuruk tribe. Now, the one problem with that is that the scope of tribal rights is a federal law issue, and the federal authorities have held that this tribe has no special fishing rights at all. And the Kuruk went to Congress to try and get fishing rights, and they couldn't get them. And in the media reports, the tribe says one of its responses to this petition, when granted, would be, well, we'll try and get federal rights. But right now, the commission, operating under the authority of the Constitution and laws of the state of California, is simply not empowered to grant special rights to some people to go kill lots of fish. Now, this special grant of rights to catch as many fish as you want, as fast as you want, has created all kinds of problems. It has caused a severe commercialization of the resource. We have people taking pickup trucks of fish down to San Francisco restaurants. We have people selling them out of houses. We have people selling salmon dinners. This is not a sustenance fishery that's going to the poor and the elderly, and a Kuruk tribal member here today will confirm that. This is an abuse of the resource. It's such an abuse that the department, the U.S. government, and the tribe itself all claim to have no idea how many fish are caught. The Los Angeles Times article that's attached to the petition, back then, it was, well, we're catching 2,000 fish. We filed a petition. All of a sudden, no, we're only catching 200 fish. But boy, to deprive us of that would be some sort of genocide. The department's representative, Neil Manji, says these are ghost fish because no one counts them. They're not included in any allocation scheme. Worse yet, these are endangered fish. The survey data, the tribe's own natural resource plan, shows that they're harvesting substantial numbers of endangered coho salmon. These are incredibly priceless fish. The commission and the department and the people of California have invested millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars to protect coho, and yet we have this unregulated, unmanaged, commercialized fishery running, and no one's doing anything about it. So we're here today to ask you to do something about it. We got a letter from the department. The department says, we don't have any authority, so we're not going to take any action on the petition. That was a few days ago. Today they say, well, we're going to investigate. The department has allowed this situation to fester for years and years and years. The department's comments in the Los Angeles Times article go back 7 years. If the commission is disposed to allow the department some time to investigate, the commission should set a time limit, because this has gone on way too long. Our members who own federal property up there have been told by the department that they must vacate their property for 9 months every year because of the risk that a salmon may be present. And it does not sit very well with them and many of the other citizens of the Klamath Basin to see people taking garbage cans full of fish out there and selling them at the same time their own rights are under attack.
Okay. Are you wrapped up?
I'm wrapped up.
Okay.
But are there any questions?
Commissioners, any questions or comments? Okay. Thank you.
James Foley, Steve Klesick, Walt Wegner. Please come, when I call your name, get close to the microphone so you're ready when it's your turn, and please state your name for the record.
Chairman Carlson, members of the commission, my name is James Foley. I'm from Klamath River, California. I represent the coalition that brought this petition to you. This petition is submitted by a broad coalition of 16 organizations consisting of thousands of members from agricultural, grazing, mining, and property rights entities. In bringing this petition, we've been accused of genocide and seeking to take the tribe's fishing rights. This petition is about one simple thing, and that is the rule of law. We're a nation of laws, and both the U.S. Constitution as well as the California State Constitution state that a class of citizens may not be granted privileges or immunities not granted on the same terms to all citizens. The commission and department cannot lawfully create special rights to fish for some Californians and not for others. It is not the state of California's role to establish tribal rights. That is a federal function and one that no state can affect outside of authorization from the federal government. The Karuk tribe holds no federal fishing rights, and its petition to Congress for such rights has been rejected. A September 22, 2008 article in the Los Angeles Times reports that the fishery is conducted in a, quote, gray area of the law, and that no one officially keeps track of the 2,000 or so salmon that the tribe can take in a good year. Neil Manji, a senior fisheries biologist for the California Department of Fish and Game, is quoted as saying, right now, their fish are not even paper fish. Anything they catch, it's kind of like a ghost fish. Coho salmon and the Klamath River are listed as a federally protected threatened species, and any take of such fish is a violation of federal law. They are also listed as threatened under California law. According to a Karuk Tribe November 2005 report on the Karuk Tribal Diet, they said that 3.2% of the Karuk households reported harvesting 10 to 50 coho.
Sir, I need you to wrap up.
A 2006 master's thesis at Humboldt State University reports that 30% of the tribal households harvest coho. The illegal exception that allows an unregulated and unmonitored fishery, especially at a time when scarcity of salmon are being used to regulate all other resource users, is patently irresponsible on the part of an agency charged with protecting fishery resources. Thank you.
Thank you.
Steve Klesick, Walt Wegner, Daniel Effman.
Good morning. My name is Steve Klesick. I'm here as an individual. I was going to talk about the special privileges offered these folks, but after hearing everybody else talking about having their rights, their seasons closed, their bag limits taken down, these folks aren't even following the outline that we have for fish and game. If you go up and float up and down the river, you'll see other areas besides the Ishipishi Falls. Anywhere there's a choke point, that's where they're fishing. They're not just using dip nets. They're using gaffs. There's nobody down there regulating this. They're not even following the procedures set forth. Really, the commission and the department really needs to look into this more, find out what's going on down there, and do some type of impact study. Thank you.
Thank you.
Walt Wegner, Daniel Effman, Catherine Updike.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Walt Wegner. I'm vice president of Public Lands for the People. We're a 501c3 nonprofit organization. We help protect citizens' right to use our public lands, and we represent all user groups, with emphasis on the mining community and to protect the public against agency abuse. It is our opinion that the Department of Fish and Game is abusing its authority by allowing the taking of coho salmon protected under the Endangered Species Act. The Crooked Indians have no federal fishing rights, as was stated earlier, especially Ishipishi, which is on the what we're speaking about here. The people of California expect the Department of Fish and Game to uphold the laws of the state and the nation with equal application of the law to all Americans. It's obvious to me that this has not been the case regarding this issue. Public Lands for the People demands that the Fish and Game take lawful actions immediately to enforce the illegal taking or harassment of this fish. What makes one group more American than another? Being born in this country makes me an American. I would be fined or imprisoned for taking or harassing this fish. Why is the Department of Fish and Game look the other way when it is no secret that these fish have been taken illegally? All the while, the Karuk tribe has past and ongoing litigation against the state, claiming that other user groups and activities are harming or killing this fish, when by their own admission, they are killing fish by the thousands. Thank you.
Thank you.
Daniel Effman, Catherine Updike, Jeff Chalateau.
My name is Daniel Effman. I'm a member of the Karuk Tribe of California. I've talked to several members of the tribe. Of course, we're kind of opposed to this action that they're suggesting that we don't fish. However, I am concerned that there is some legal activity going on of selling fish, which I am opposed to and have witnessed and have bought myself. But again, I'm not opposed to us having our fishing rights at Itchy-Pitchy Falls. So I'd like to submit to the board some photographs and some statements and signatures from other tribal members. And that's about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Catherine Updike, Jeff Shalito, Craig Tucker.
Hello.
Good morning.
Basically, I support the testimony they've just given, and they've covered most everything that I was intending to say. So I thank you for your time.
Thank you for coming down for this. I know it's quite a drive.
Jeff Shalito, Craig Tucker, Robert Goodwin.
I'm going to cede my time to Craig Tucker.
Thank you.
Craig Tucker, you get 3 minutes.
Hi, my name is Craig Tucker. I'm the Klamath coordinator for the Cudahy Tribe. The Cudahy Tribe is the second biggest tribe in California, and historically, there are over 120 Cudahy villages in the Klamath River and Salmon Rivers, and each one of those villages had an associated fishery. Early anthropologists such as Kroeber described the Kurok as the wealthiest people in North America. Today, the Kurok among the poorest people in North America. What the Kurok have left, one of the vestiges of their culture, is ability to dip net at Itchy-Pitchy Falls. California Fish and Game acknowledged years ago that the Kurok dip net fishery had a negligible impact on the overall runs of salmon in the Klamath River. And if folks think it's easy to stand at Itchy-Pitchy Falls and catch as many fish as you want, you've never worked a Cudahy dip net. They're big, they're heavy, and you only get to catch fish, when there's fish in the river, which is today, because of dams, diversions, and other problems, additionally, suction dredge mining, the number of fish we have in the river is quite limited. And so Cudahy dip net fishing evolved over centuries, if not thousands of years, to have a modest impact on the overall numbers of fish in the river. So the amount of fish we can harvest is very small and is directly dependent on the number of fish in the river. The window of opportunity to catch fish used to be almost year-round. We had multiple runs of fish in almost every season. Today, there's a very short window of opportunity for Cudahy to fish, and it's in mid-August to mid-September, and that's when there's a run, a fall run Chinook headed up the river. The dip net fishery is a non-lethal fishery, so we are able, when we harvest fish, if there's ESA-listed coho or other fish, they're returned to the river. That's different than a lot of other fishing methods, including sport fishing methods where hooks are used. So the Kurok fishery is a non-lethal fishing method and allows the fishermen to pick and choose what to keep and what to put back in the river. And it's gear-limited, so because of the methodology, there's a limit on, you know, the percentage of fish coming through the falls that can be harvested. Tribes did have and do have the technology to catch every fish in the river, and that technology is the building of fish weirs and other things. That's not used anymore because of the fishery being in the state that it's in. So we ask that you reject this petition and acknowledge that more than a concern for coho or fish, this petition is the product of really an act of revenge by mining groups. For several years, the Cudahy Tribe and mining groups have been in a battle over when, where, and the appropriateness of suction dredge mining in the Klamath River. We've petitioned Fish and Game to limit suction dredge mining. We've litigated to limit suction dredge mining. And the petition put forth by these miners has more to do with that battle than it does a concern for fish. Thanks.
Okay, Robert Goodwin, followed by E.B. Dugan.
Good afternoon, and I'm Robert Goodwin. I'm a Kurok tribal member. I'm also the self-governance coordinator for the Kurok tribe. And there's been a lot of things said today about our fishery at Itchy-Pitchy Falls. First thing I'd like to say is that I thank the commission for hearing us and hearing some of my thoughts. And some of these people are saying that we don't have any federally recognized fishing rights. The Kurok tribe has never ceded any of its fishing rights. And we would like to extend thanks to the California Department of Fish and Game and the state of California for recognizing the fact that we do have a right to fish in a traditional method in one of our most sacred places. Itchy-Pitchy Falls is right next to the center of our Cudahy world, where we do the world renewal ceremonies. And for these people to come here and tell you that we're slaughtering fish or we're murdering fish and we're selling fish, it's absolutely ridiculous. When we go down there, we pack these fish a mile, one or two at a time, from the place where we catch them all the way up the ceremonial trail to the top of the river up there where they're cleaned. It's not like you drive your pickup truck down there and spread a net across the river and then you catch 50 of them in 10 minutes and walk away. Catching as many as you want, as fast as you want, that is an absurd, absurd statement. People talking about the different things that have gone on here, I would like to say that as a representative of the Karuk tribe, a former tribal council member of 7 years, and currently the self-governance director for the tribe, I would request that before any action is taken to restrict our rights and our Aboriginal rights to fish at Ishipishi Falls, that we would ask that the state of California enter into government-to-government consultation and allow us to have the time to speak together and make a decision that is based on science. Every year, the Karuk tribe spends literally hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, on conservation efforts in the Klamath River. We are not there to destroy the species. We are there to maintain the integrity of the species. Our tribal members are held down at this point to where they can barely get one or two fish per family, and we want to be able to see that go on. We don't want it to see it end. So I thank you for your time.
Final speaker, E.B. Dugan.
Thank you, Commissioners. My name is E.B. Dugan. I'm not speaking in behalf of anybody but myself as a local resident of the area, having been there for 23 years and knowing many of the different Indian tribal members, both Karuk, Hupa, and Yurok. I do appreciate the fact that they're trying to do subsistence fishing at Ishipishi Falls. I am concerned that we have an agency or a group of people that I feel have just as much degradation to our river system as what they're claiming another group is. And I think that at this time, I'd like to see the commission here at least defer or refer this consideration back to the federal government where it belongs. I'm just really concerned about this type of a thing because I think that many of the tribal members have inherited rights over the years, but I also go back to the point we do need enforcement, and one of the things we need to do is have the enforcement both in counting, Creole counting, and as well as law enforcement along the river, and that goes for the Klamath and the Trinity. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Madam Chairman.
Yes.
I appreciate all the speakers, and I've read the petition, I've read the related material. I've also worked in the Klamath Basin quite a bit on the what is becoming the largest river restoration project in the United States history. And that includes a number of overflights that I've done over the upper basin, the projects, and the lower river as well. It strikes me that this issue is far more complex than the petitioners would have us believe. Whatever action we take, it seems to me, ought to be taken in the context of the restoration of this river basin as a whole. And with that in mind, I'm going to suggest that we either deny this petition or hold it over, because I'm not convinced on the evidence that has been presented here that this petition is worth us adopting today.
Okay. Jim?
Madam Chairman, I'd like to make a motion.
Okay.
That the Fish and Game Commission hereby denies Mr. Buechel's request to amend Section 7.50B 91.1B2 Title 14.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you for being here. Thanks for your input. Okay.
That brings us to item number 25.
23.
Oops. Yes, 23.
I'm going to take the lead on these next two items, I think. I had suggested that for commission business, And because sometimes commissioners have requests between meetings, and then they're asking staff to follow up on items, that we at each meeting put this on the agenda. If there's items that commissioners want to see agendized or action, that we have an opportunity to discuss this each meeting. And that way, during the course of a month, we don't bombard staff with additional requests from one commissioner or two commissioners. So is there any commission follow-up, any items or new requests from commissioners to staff to look into items? Yes, Adriana? Jim?
John? Well, real quick, I just want to let the commissioners know we, in preparation for these items, we have been, the staff has been keeping a list of what happened over the last couple days. And after you have some comments, if you want, I can run down the list to make sure that that is, you know, this is a basically a to-do list after this meeting.
Okay. And that would be item number 21.
The department also, I know that Sonke and I have kind of talked about this over the years. It would be very helpful also. And we do debrief after these meetings.
Okay.
But to make sure we're all on
and
the
I've
same
been keeping
page
a list,
direction.
Too. So we'll do that on 24. But 23, commissioners, do you have any requests from our staff now? And what I'd like us to remember is that we do need, you know, three of us to agree before staff sets out on a direction of a new report or a new item. So if there's nothing right now, but in the future, let's try to talk about them at this point in each agenda. So I'm not seeing anybody with requests right now. Jim? Okay. So we'll go to 24, meeting review and staff direction. John, you want to go through your list?
Sure.
And I'll see if you got all mine.
Sounds good. The department,
okay.
I don't know if Sonke has a list or not. He might listen up, though. Scheduled presentation from Sherry Recchia, Monitoring Enterprise for the May meeting. Scheduled meeting with Dan and Richard and the aquaculturists regarding a new lease template, and I know that is in the works for, I believe, May 13th. Scheduled MLPA regulatory hearings for May and August. That it will be in the works. We're expecting the department's ISOR to come to us either today or tomorrow, is my understanding. We need to have it to OAL on Tuesday. So, and we need time for the staff. So, my understanding is it's in pretty good shape, right? If that's changed, we're going to have to maybe adjust some things.
Well, we will make our Tuesday deadline, but I don't want to write a check that I can't cash right now. Won't get it.
Monday's a more, at this point, realistic. I don't see how Friday's going to happen.
Okay. We will work with you. Our staff will work with you guys on that. Next item, schedule ratification of Longfin findings for May on the May agenda. Next one is prepare bill analysis for commission consideration at May meeting. We have five potential bills, and I wanted to remind the commissioners that right now we really do not have a legislative unit within the commission staff, and to do an intense or in-depth analysis of five bills is going to be a major burden in compared to everything else going on with the commission staff. So I'm not promising a in-depth analysis of these five bills. We will work on them and work with the department staff and bring you some information back at the May meeting.
That's fine. I don't think we expected in-depth, but just a little more time to analyze those bills. And they sounded like good items that we would support. But if there's a major issue there, we want to make sure we hear about it. Okay.
Staff has been directed to work on a letter to the California District Attorneys Association encouraging prosecution of wildlife crimes, and I'm actually planning on working closely with Chief Foley on that letter. Might need to go to other folks also, and I will work closely with the president and the vice president on that. Prepare a report for May for the potential commission involvement in the Biodiversity Council. Actually, I'll probably have a suggested motion to join. Agenda is a half-day workload planning meeting session for June, and we will work on that.
Okay. I had one other item. We did ask Chief Foley to come back with a report on the Salinas River issues and what was going on there, so we want to make sure we hear that about that.
Did you hear that, Nancy?
It's okay. She's going to do it, I know, but just that we had asked about the Salinas River.
Shake your head up and down.
What's going on there with the enforcement actions. And I do think Mr. Dugan asked us about, in public comment, I made a note that he asked us about the status of the youth report cards for salmon steelhead. And I don't think Neil was here at the time, but if we could get some information on that. That can just come in a report or in an update next, just in an update to the department's report next month.
Okay.
Or a memo, whatever, however you want to get it to us.
So Neil will get right on that, right, Neil? Steelhead, okay.
Put your head
up. That was the only other items I had that you didn't cover. So,
Madam President, I have one announcement.
Okay.
I've been working with Chief Foley and some of the wardens to get the warden shoot coordinated this year. And it looks like we're going to have that June the 2nd in DeVore, California, which is north of San Bernardino at the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Facility. So I want to put that on your calendars, make sure everybody knows about that. And I know they love having the commissioners there. So if anybody can make it, we'd love to have you in Southern California.
Thank you. Anything else? Okay, then we're moving to item number 25. Future announcement of future meetings.
Yes. As we have said, we will go to notice on the April 21st teleconference call. Tomorrow, and that's a 10-day notice that's required by law, and that will do salmon regs and possible adoption and mammal possible adoption on April 21st, and that announcement will have public locations for the commissioners to be on the telephone and one commissioner at our office, so we've been working with that with the commissioners. And then our next regularly scheduled commission meeting is May 13th and 14th. That will be in the Resources Building in Sacramento. Then we meet in June, August, September, October, November, and December. And all those locations are posted on our website. And we're in pretty good shape for the rest of the year. Looks like we will return here for a couple of meetings and be in Woodland for most of the rest of the meetings beyond next month.
Okay. If there's nothing else, we'll stand adjourned. Thank you very much.